Okay, we are plugged into the Matrix today and ready to rock and roll. So it's Sunday, the 24th of September, 2017. Unbelievable. It's going fast, but you're listening to Crass Files Podcast with Adam and all of the podcasts and everything else is up on my website, crassfiles.com, C-R-A-Z-Z. It's all up there. So lots to go through and always updating the site with lots of interesting articles, links there, and videos, and tons to go through over on the website, so check it out daily. And the podcast will also go over to iTunes if you want to get it that way. But you can also subscribe through the website, and you can check us out over at Facebook as well under the Crass Files, Twitter. I'm locked out of my YouTube account. I can't get into there. I don't know why. It's like I don't exist. I think it's still there. But check that out, the Crass Files. You can also send an email. I have a new email, which is thecrassfiles@mail.com. So any things we might find interesting or any comments about the shows or whatever, send it through to there, or just comment on the website, because there's a rolling, scrolling comments bar so the public can see people's comments and click on them and have a look. So turn it into your own blog, put up whatever you would like to, and I don't censor anything unless it's trolls or something like that, but let us know what you think about the shows and the articles going up. You can check out opensourcetruth.com, our other great website as well. But Wayne Bush is plugged in with me again today. Done a lot of shows with Wayne Bush from Texas, so good to plug in with you for another show as we move forward and try and unravel this reality on display, Wayne, that we're shown. We're not sure about it, so we're questioning everything we can, but good to get you plugged in again.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Adam. I really appreciate you having me on your show again. It's always an interesting time.
That's right. And we've done a lot of different shows with you, and they're very popular shows. You're very highly respected, and people really enjoy them. We really talk about the nature of reality. We've done many, many different podcasts, so people can go up on Crass Files and find them all there as well. But we always do talk about your great website, trickedbythelight.com. And how much there is to go through. And so what I thought would be great, because, you know, we've covered bits and pieces and a lot of NDE, near-death experiences, things like that. We covered, you know, the ayahuasca experiences and all of this, so many things with you. But, you know, you've got a lot of stuff up on there on, you know, even politics and logos and language, which we're going to try and do a podcast soon, but I know that's going to be a big one. But one of the very interesting subjects that you go through and you're going to go through today with us is, you know, movies and symbolism in movies and all of this sort of occult symbols or whatnot. And you've got a lot of info up on the side, which I'm going to sort of follow today. But, you know, music clips and video clips and movies, you know, big films, big budget films right through history that we've all watched and know well. There's a lot of symbolism and hidden things in here to do with the Gnostic beliefs and all of this. So we have a pretty big show to go through. So you're going to present this one today for us. And so we're really just going through all the different parts of trickedbythelight.com to sort of, you know, give it a bit more time, because there's a lot of info up here, my friend, on this. And I know, going on YouTube and going on a lot of websites myself, a lot of people are interested in this, Wayne, because I notice so much weird stuff going on in movies. And I was just watching the, I think it was the American MTV Music Awards from 2017. Oh, yeah. And there's all these half-naked girls up there. It's almost like they were doing these ritualistic orgies, you know, on stage. And, you know, people question the Super Bowls and these kinds of big events and all sorts of things. And they say it seems very symbolic, you know, with Madonna and these music stars, the way they act and dress. It's getting very sexualized now. But, you know, right through to cartoons and Disney movies and, you know, things like Star Trek, all of this, there's all this hidden symbology and things going on and stuff that you've researched so deeply. So it would be good to go into this today. So, you know, you start where you think we should go here.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I mean, for the ride.
The devil's in the details, so I'm glad that we're just, you know, jumping in and delving real deeply into each of the different topics. But, yeah, the subject of today's show is Hollywood movies. And, you know, here on Earth, we love our entertainment, whether it's the big ball game, a Hollywood movie, or a rock concert. You know, the movie industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, and the budget for some of the Hollywood blockbusters can run into hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, movies are an outlet for the masses to escape the everyday drudgery of their jobs and problems. And, of course, much of the news that's presented to us on TV is fake news, and the truth is often presented to us in the guise of fiction. So I'm going to go over some movies that have Gnostic themes and reveal aspects of the hidden truth behind this reality, and also touch on a couple others that aren't Gnostic themed but serve the agenda of the Archons by generating fear and negativity. But we'll notice the underlying themes that run throughout these movies. You know, the imagery and message of movies and music videos are received by the conscious mind, and the symbolism goes into the deeper levels of the unconscious mind or subconscious mind, for those that prefer that terminology. So when you look at Hollywood, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences presents the Emmy Awards, and its acronym is NATAS, or Satan backwards. I mean, it can't be a coincidence, right? And so then the Oscar statue, the Oscar Awards, it gets its name from Osir, or Osiris, the Egyptian god of the dead. And both figures are golden, have their arms crossed across the chest, and hold a scepter. And then you have the DreamWorks logo, which is DreamWorks Pictures introduces its movies with this short animation of a boy sitting on the moon and fishing in a body of water, which is, you know, perhaps symbolic of the subconscious mind where dreams are born. But, you know, this presumably the Earth below. And, you know, this is similar also to the siren motif, which usually features an attractive woman luring sailors to their deaths with her sweet song and alluring eyes. Then you have Columbia, who's like the torch lady of Columbia Pictures, and she stands on a mountain or stepped pyramid and holds the light above her head with her right hand. And the logo represents Venus or Lucifer, who originally was Prometheus, the god who stole light and gave it to mankind. And Prometheus held the fire up in his hand in a fennel stalk, similar to the depiction of Columbia. Kenneth Anger, who was the director of Lucifer Rising, said, "Making movies is casting spells." And researcher Jordan Maxwell said, "Magic wands were always made out of the wood of a holly tree. It's made out of holly wood. Hollywood is a druidic establishment, and the symbols, the words, the terms, the stories are designed," end quote. And, you know, after all, they use terms such as casting and programming. And, you know, movies and television's programs use what's called predictive programming to program us by using fiction and the power of suggestion to create whatever desired outcome they want. It's life imitating art. And there are countless movies which depict inorganic predators in the form of black goo, insects, shadow beings. And of course, there's movies about vampires who feed off the life force or blood of humans, and they can shapeshift into flying creatures, bats, and live in the darkness, and they're susceptible to the sunlight. There's also the popular zombie movies where the living dead feed off the brains of humans. This also feeds into the fear of the zombie apocalypse. And the truth is we are about as dead and asleep right now as our spirit ever will be. But the most obvious example of the overt programming is the oft-repeated message to go to the light at death, or the sometimes tongue-in-cheek message to stay away from the light if the speaker doesn't want their loved one to die. And Hollywood reinforces this through various movies such as Ghost and Poltergeist, and it can be seen in countless movies. I hardly watch any TV at all, but just a couple weeks ago I heard yet another example. About the only show I watch on an ongoing basis right now is America's Got Talent. But to give an example of how cliche the meme has become, one of the judges, Howie Mandel, told a contestant, quote, "I said last night you're a beacon of light and beauty for Houston, for America, for the world, for humanity. And in movies, you always hear this saying, go toward the light. And I think America just did. They went toward the light, and you're the light, end quote. And I know a few other examples offhand. A noteworthy example is in the movie A Bug's Life, where a bug was flying toward a light zapper or light trap, and one of his friends implores him, "No, Harry, no, don't look at the light." But it's to no avail, as the victim laments, "I can't help it, it's so beautiful." Another example was in the movie Finding Nemo, and two fish, Dory and Marlin, are deep underwater, and it's extremely dark. And this scene features an anglerfish. It's a real fish which lures its prey to death by dangling a light out in front. And I'm going to read the conversation between the two fish, and Dory sees a light and thinks she's dead. And so notice the direct comparison is made to the afterlife. She says the light is so pretty and that she's feeling happy. So Marlin says, "Dory, do you see anything?" And Dory says, "Ah, something's got me." He goes, "That was me. I'm sorry." She's like, "Who was that?" "Well, who could it be? It's me. Are you my conscience?" Yeah, I'm your conscience. We haven't spoken for a while. How are you?" And she's like, "Can't complain." It's like, "Good. Now, Dory, I want you to tell me, do you see anything?" She says, I see a light." Marlin says, "A light?" And she says, "Yeah, over there. Hey, conscience, am I dead?" He says, "No, I see it too. What is it?" She says, "It's so pretty." He says, "I'm feeling happy," which is a big deal for me. Dory says, "I want to touch it." He says, "Oh, hey, come back. Come on back here." She sings, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. I'm going to swim with you." And he says, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to be your best friend." Good feeling's gone. And he says, "I can't see. I don't know where I'm going." She says, "The mask." She says, "What mask?" And she says, "I can't see a thing." And there's a mask. And she says, "Oh, could you bring a little closer? I kind of need the light." "That's great. Keep it right there." And he says, "Don't eat me. Don't eat me." And the Dory says, "Light, please." And then Marlin says, "I'm dead. I'm dead. I'm dead. I'm dead." So, you know, there's this anglerfish which is luring them to be a meal with this light that he's just dangling out in front. And in the movie Poltergeist, the psychic medium tells the little girl, Carol Ann, she says, "Run to the light, Carol Ann, run as fast as you can. Mommy is in the light. Mommy is waiting for you in the light." And she says, "Mommy, where are you? I can't find you. I can't. I'm afraid of the light, Mommy. I'm afraid of the light." And the doctor tells her to stay away from the light. And you know, the question about maybe it's a way out, and the doctor says it is. It's a way out, but not for her. Tell her quickly. And then they tell her to stay away from the light. The light is dangerous. Don't go near it. Don't even look at the light. And the little girl says, "Mommy, there's somebody here. Mommy, somebody's coming. Mommy, help me, please. Get away from me. Leave me alone." And, you know, I actually have a series of images on my website on the movies page that shows all the movies and television shows that use the light and tunnel imagery in their poster ads. And they include The Ring, Gamer, Prometheus, Prison Break, Moon, Close Encounters, Death Tunnel, Lord of Illusions, Surrogates, The Hypnotist, The Tunnel, Moonraker, and Knowing. And in a poster for the movie Daredevil, the devil, red suit and all, is posing with the full moon. And in the movie, the daredevil tells a dying man, quote, "The light at the end of the tunnel, guess what? That's not heaven. It's the sea train." And the dying man threatens, "I'll kill you. I'll kill you." And of course, the crescent moon does look like a sea in the sea of space. And, you know, the tagline of the tagline on a poster of the movie The Ring was, "Before you die, you see the ring." And the ring looks just like a solar eclipse. And in the movie Batman, the Joker says to Batman prior to shooting at him, "Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I ask that of all my prey." So I'm going to start by analyzing one of the most well-known and beloved movies of all time, the 1939 MGM classic, The Wizard of Oz. And the classic movie was written by L. Frank Baum, who was a noted member of the Theosophical Society, who rejected Christianity and converted to Gnosticism 2 years before writing the book. And he included many Gnostic elements in the book. There are so many overtones. The light of the NDE, or near-death experiences, past the tunnel, which is represented by the tornado or vortex, and over the rainbow. And, of course, all the colors can be seen in the tunnel. And in the Emerald City, which, you know, Crystal City is seen in a lot of near-death experiences. And the characters and attributes of the Tin Man, Scarecrow, etc., represent the redemption of those lacking in some essential quality and ultimately being restored and causing their life to be almost reborn. And the wizard, the frail old man behind the curtain running the show, is the Demiurge. seemingly all fears, but really nothing in essence. You know, quote, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. You know, the scarecrow needed a brain to acquire knowledge or gnosis. The cowardly lion needed courage to overcome fear. The tin man had to learn to love with his heart. And Dorothy, representing the consciousness being immersed, had to kill the evil witch, which represented her ego or counterfeit spirit, in order to progress. And the good witch was the enlightened afterthought propelling us onward. And Dorothy talks about some place where there isn't any trouble, and says it's far, far away, quote, behind the moon, beyond the rain, quote, somewhere over the rainbow. And she's looking for Annie M., which in the storm, which becomes a vortex. So EM, that sounds like an electromagnetic storm to me. And when she crosses over the rainbow into Munchkin Land, it's kind of reminiscent of the DMT elves or the Archons. And they say she fell from a star, which is similar to the myth of Lucifer or perhaps Sophia. And they make a big deal about saying she is dead. So she is dead and went through the tunnel into this place. And before they get to the Emerald City, the Wicked Witch has used poppies to drug them and put a spell on them. No one has seen the Great Oz. He projects himself as a green-headed looking alien. I like the analogy of Dorothy going through the vortex tunnel over the rainbow of color and into the dream world or the astral, and the demiurge wizard using tricks and deception to run the crystal city of light. It's very similar to near-death experiences. And the lyrics even say to step into the light before they enter the Emerald City. And then Dorothy repeats a mantra. There's no place like home, no place like home, with her focused intent in order to wake up from the dream and to return back home. The ruby slippers represent the inner spark within all of us. And when Glinda instructs Dorothy never to take off the ruby slippers, she is telling Dorothy never to lose her inner spark. And Glinda the Good Witch tells Dorothy, you don't need to be helped any longer. You've always had the power. And this is the key component of Gnosticism, that the soul is the divine spark and has the light power within. The Wizard of Oz essentially contains the formula for how to escape this matrix and return home. You know, Dorothy clicking her heels and repeating over and over again the mantra, there's no place like home. In order to return home, we definitely need to maintain a continual focus on raising our frequency, almost like repeating a mantra. Okay, that was the Wizard of Oz. Next, I'm going to go to from an old classic to a more modern example of Gnosticism with the movie The Matrix. Well, it's actually a trilogy. But I believe The Matrix was responsible in waking many people up to the possibility that this reality we live in is indeed a matrix or computer simulation. And it's a sci-fi classic where Neo is told humans are nothing more than a battery, the source of power for the machine, and that he is living in a false world, a matrix. So at the beginning, you know, he's in front of the computer, and the computer screen says, wake up, Neo, the Matrix has you. And he says, what the hell? You know, and it says, follow the white rabbit. So Neo's asleep in a dream world and needs to pay attention to archetypes and symbolism. And the book where Neo stashes this computer disk or programs is called Simulacra and Simulation. The guy then tells Neo he's his savior and that if you get caught, you know, you don't exist. Neo said, ever had that feeling where you're not sure if you're awake or still dreaming? And they tell him he needs to unplug. And Trinity says, I brought you here to warn you. They're watching you, Neo. And then they start talking about something called the question. And the question is, what is the Matrix? And he goes to this place called Metacortex. And the boss there says, every employee understands they are part of the whole. Then you have Morpheus, the god of dreams, and he guides Neo out of his cubicle prison at work, where Agent Smith and the police are coming to take him. And Agent Smith puts an Archon-like bug in his stomach. Neo wakes up in bed. Morpheus calls him, tells him he's the one, and tells him to go to the bridge where Trinity picks him up and removes the bug. And Morpheus says, you have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he's expecting to wake up. He says, you're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you felt it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. Do you know what I'm talking about? He says, the Matrix? He says, do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It's all around us. It's the world that's been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth, that you are a slave, Neo, Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch, a prison for your mind. He sees millions of humans hooked up to machines. He gets unplugged and goes through a tunnel, and Morpheus says, "Welcome to the real world." And then, you know, they do all these, they're broadcasting pirate signals and hacking into the Matrix, and he's telling you about the Matrix from a clear white void, the construct or loading program, which can load anything, training simulations inside a computer program, and they talk about the mental projection of your digital self. Morpheus tells Neo, what is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can see, what you can feel, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain. This is the world that you know. It exists now only as part of a neural interactive simulation that we call the Matrix. You've been living in a dream world, Neo. And then man, he tells him, man unified and gave birth to AI, a singular consciousness that spawned an entire race of machines. He says, welcome to the desert of the real. They, the machines, were dependent on solar power, and it was believed that they would be unable to survive without an energy source as abundant as the sun. The human body carries more bioelectricity than a 120-volt battery and over 125,000 BTUs of body heat. Combined with a form of fusion, the machines had found, and he said, there are fields, endless fields, where human beings are no longer born. We are grown. He says, what is the Matrix? Control. The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world built to keep us under control in order to change a human being into this. And he shows a battery to Neo. He says, as long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free. He says, we never free a mind once it's reached a certain age. It's dangerous. The mind has trouble letting go. So, you know, it's referring to our attachments to the world. Says, and they put him in this simulation for a learning programs and stuff. He says, don't think you are, know you are. Stop trying to hit me and hit me. He says, you have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind. And then they talk about these sentient programs. Anyone we haven't unplugged is potentially an agent. They are gatekeepers. They are guarding all the doors. They are holding all the keys. And Agent Smith tells them, the first Matrix was designed to be a perfect human world where no one suffered, where everyone would be happy, and it was a disaster. No one would accept the program. Entire crops were lost. So, you know, he says, human beings as a species define their reality through misery and suffering. In the perfect world you kept trying to wake up from. He says, as soon as we started thinking for you, it became our civilization, is what this is all about, evolution. And all the Agent Smiths look the same. They're like clones or copies. They're like memes. And he's comparing the humans to a virus. He says, I hate this place, this zoo, this prison, this reality. The sentinels in the movie are artificial intelligence and are cross between metal, robotic insects, viruses, and squid or octopi, as they have tentacles. And Neo, which is an enneagram for the one, believes in himself enough, then it's apparent he is the one, and he's able to stop bullets in midair. And he effortlessly fights off Agent Smith's attack and jumps inside of Agent Smith. He travels to his brain or third eye region, and Agent Smith explodes into light. In Gnostic terms, the darkness or shadow is transformed by the light power of Neo. And the ending shows the Matrix has a system failure as Neo phones the people of the Earth and tells them he's going to show them a world without rules, controls, and boundaries, a world where anything is possible. And Neo puts on a pair of sunglasses, looks up toward the heavens, and flies away, ascending into the atmosphere. So the ending is about ascension. And in the sequel, The Matrix Reloaded, birds, trees, wind, etc. are all programs running. And the Oracle tells Neo, a program can either choose to hide here or return to the source, the machine mainframe where you must go, where the path of the one ends. And she talks about a door made of light in his dreams. And she's saying the source is the machine and that the light leads to the machine. She says, you can return to Zion if you reach the source, but to do that, you'll need to the Keymaker, and he's a program. He's being held prisoner. It's being held prisoner by an old program called the Merovingian. And many Agent Smiths surround Neo and tell him everything is because of purpose, and they need to take back the purpose that Neo took from them. And Agent Smith tries to assimilate Neo, and Neo starts turning into black goo. And Merovingian's wife, Persephone, takes him to the Keymaker, who is through a tunnel that has prison bars at the front end of it. And Merovingian tells Persephone it's only a game after cheating on her. And it looks like the Sentinels are coming through a tunnel from the sun. The Keymaker says there's a level in the building not reachable from elevators or stairs, and it has doors, one of which leads to the source. They must destroy a power station to take out the grid network, and all must be done as one. And the chair on which Morpheus is sitting in the Keymaker's building has lion symbolism on it. And then Neo goes through the door of light and returns to the source, where he meets the architect, who's a demiurgic type figure who created the Matrix. He is white-haired and wearing a business suit and extremely serious. There are hundreds to thousands of computer screens showing different parts of Neo's lives, including his reactions to meeting the architect. He calls Neo an anomaly of a harmony of mathematical precision and says this is the sixth version of the Matrix. Neo deduces the problem as choice. Those who refuse the program pose a threat to the system. He says Neo must return to Source and to comply with his orders, and failure to do so would result in the annihilation of all humans. Neo says he won't annihilate all human beings because he needs them to survive. The architect says Neo's love and emotion and attachment to his love Trinity will blind him. And then the last movie, Revolutions, Neo is in between the machine and Matrix worlds and meets the power plant system manager for recycling operations. And the Oracle says the architect's purpose is to balance the equation and that her purpose is to unbalance the equation. Agent Smith refers to the other Smiths as, quote, the rest of me, indicating they are a collective. And Agent Smith tries to assimilate Neo into the black goo. Neo becomes an Agent Smith, but accesses the light power from within and transmutes all the Agent Smiths in the light. The machines leave and the war is over. Neo saves them. At the end, the architect talks with the Oracle and tells her she's, quote, made a very dangerous game, end quote. This implies that she might be a creative goddess, and that the Matrix was necessary for her game, and that the architect was the one in charge of making or administrating the Matrix, or that perhaps they were co-creators. Some say that the term demiurge literally means half-creator, and in some Gnostic interpretations, they share responsibility for the recreation of this universe. And incidentally, Freemasons call God the great architect of the universe. The architect says the ones that want out will be freed, and the sun rises and is said to be beautiful. The Oracle says she didn't know, but she believed. Okay, that was the Matrix trilogy there. The next one is another interesting one, which is a Disney movie called Tron Legacy. In the first movie, Tron, I think, was out in the 70s. You know, Disney's usually cartoons and all this stuff, but when they make a serious sci-fi type movie, there must be a reason behind it, you know. And so in the movie, Kevin Flynn is talking to his son, Sam, and he's telling how they raced on ribbons of light. And he said, together we built a new grid for programs and users. He says, I couldn't be in there all the time, so I created a program in my own image that could think like you and me. And I called him Clue, C-L-U, which codified light disk utility. And Tron, Clue, and I built a system where all information was free. And then one day something happened, something extraordinary, a miracle, end quote. But, you know, is Clue, C-U-L, an anagram for L-U-C or an abbreviation for Lucifer? So they keep talking about the light grid system being a digital frontier to reshape the human condition. And Flynn's talking about the computer game system says, in there is a new world, in there is our future, in there is your destiny. Flynn goes missing, and Sam enters the video game in search of him, his father. And he's given an identity disk where everything he does and learns is imprinted on the disk. He enters a bright white light and enters a battle game for the entertainment of a crowd of spectators. His dad was trapped in the grid and now is in charge. Sam must now battle Clue in the light cycle grid. Flynn teaches about being selfless and removing oneself from the equation. Clue was a program designed to create the perfect world. Something unexpected happened, a miracle. ISOs, isomorphic algorithms, you know, and is ISOs, ISIS, I don't know. A whole new life form, control, order, perfection, none of it meant a thing. They manifested like a flame. The conditions were right and they came into being. ISOs were going to be his gift to the world, but Clue happened. Clue fed on Flynn's resistance. The harder he fought, the more powerful Clue became, and Clue saw the ISOs as an imperfection, so he destroyed them. And then there's a portal of light that uses massive power and can only stay open for a while. It can only be open from the outside, and the portal closed on him, and he couldn't get back home. Okay, that was Tron Legacy. Here's one of my very favorite movies is The Truman Show. And some taglines from the movie are on the air, unaware, the world is watching, and the world is a stage. And in the movie, The Truman Show, he's the true man. It's the true man. But Truman Burbank's whole life in Sea Haven is staged and phony. His whole world, including the sun and moon, is a gigantic set inside a large dome controlled from the moon. And Jim Carrey plays True Man, which is a metaphor for the true man. He's living in a false artificial world, a hoax perpetrated from the lunar room, a world within a world. Truman is the only authentic person in this artificially constructed world. The people in his life are mere actors, and the whole set is being controlled by a hidden director in the sky. And by the way, the Egyptian equivalent for Satan is named Set. Could it be that True Man is inside a vast dome and that our world is controlled from a base on the moon? Truman, trying to conquer his fear and escape, sets sail for the blue skies only to collide into a giant wall. And this movie was hailed by critics as original and daring. Why? Because it contains our true origins and is daring to tell us the truth. One of the movie's producers is a Rothschild, the family that started the European banking dynasty. Now, I don't know if he's actually a member of that family or not, but his last name is Rothschild. But it's a reality TV show. Wayne.
It's the closest movie, Wayne, I think, to everything we're talking about. I've never seen a movie like The Truman Show. I always mention it, you know, that we're living in The Truman Show. You know, people,
it's amazing, and I'm going to go through it, and some of the quotes
it was
are like,
people thought it was a comedy, though, didn't they? They kind of saw it as a comedy, yeah. A fun comedy. A lot of people sort of missed it, and it's one of those films that, you know, many, many years later, you keep going back to, and sometimes it's on TV, and I always watch it. It's just, every time I do, it blows me away, and there's so much but I don't think there's ever been a movie made like it. Yeah,
I identified so much with Truman when I watched it.
It was so well done, and such a great performance by Jim Carrey. He's such a great actor. Mm-hmm. It was so well done, and it was just nothing like it. You know that.
Yeah, I liked it so much. I actually bought the transcript or whatever the pitched to the movie industry. You know, I forget what they call those. Anyway, at the very beginning of the movie, Truman is looking at himself in the mirror. And unknown to him, he's talking to millions of viewers that are watching him. He says, if I die before I reach the summit, you'll use me as an alternative source for food. You know, so I've been talking about how, you know, there's all these different levels of planes of existence and we need to, you know, ascend, you know, higher and higher and beyond just that first external light. So he's saying, if I die before I reach the summit, you'll use me as an alternative source for food. And he says, eat me. Outside, as he heads for work, a light canister falls from the sky, and it's labeled Sirius, 9 Canis Major. And they try to cover it up with a news story talking about an aircraft shedding parts as it flies over. His wife is reading a book called The Dream Machine 2. And then one compassionate actor in the show, who's Truman's love interest, secretly tells him, everybody knows everything you do. Everybody's pretending this. It's fake. It's all for you. Everything is all for you. The sea, the sand, the sky is all set. It's a show. In one scene, Truman hears a different frequency on the radio and hears the truth. It's only when the frequency changes back that his normal life resumes again. His friend tells him, "Look at that sunset. That's the big guy." Truman meets his dead father on a bridge in fog. And then at one point, the creator and director of the show, Christoph, explains how they were able to fool Truman. He says, "We accept the reality of the world which we are presented." And Truman lives under a dome city. It's an island surrounded by water, essentially. And he becomes suspicious and sneaks off in a boat to leave the island in search of his true home. And once they discover Truman's missing, the moon becomes a searchlight. And then they say, "Cue the sun." And it's nighttime, you know. They're searching for him with the moon and the sun as lights. And then the demiurgic type figure named Christoph finds him and calls up the weather program, causing a storm which capsizes the boat. Truman barely holds on to survive. And once the storm is over, Truman sails for blue skies, but literally runs into a wall at sea, the boundary of the movie set and his world. He climbs a set of stairs to meet his creator, and a booming voice comes from the sky, the voice of Christoph, saying, "You can speak. I can hear you." And Truman, you know, he can't see him. He says, "Who are you?" And Christoph says, "I am the creator of a television show that gives hope and joy to inspiration to millions." And Truman says, "Well, then who am I?" He says, "You're the star." He says, "It's nothing real." He says, "You were real. That's what made you so good to watch." And at one point, Christoph made this statement about Truman. He said he could leave at any time. If this were anything more than a vague ambition, if he was absolutely determined to discover the truth, there was no way we could prevent him. It's just a brilliant show, as I'm sure you think too.
He's absolutely.
Yeah, and then
I like how he kind of starts. I like how he sort of slowly clues on to things, you know. It kind of creepy in its own way.
There's that scene where he's sitting in the car and he's watching the cars go around in circles and circles, and he starts seeing that it's all just like a program or something. Then he starts acting spontaneously. Remember that?
I think there was an earlier movie, something about Ed or something with Matthew McConaughey. I'll try and look it up. Where he's like it's the same sort of thing. And yeah, it was introduced. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had the Big Brother shows where people are living in a house and being filmed. It's really tried
those
to
are
normalize
the very first reality TV show idea.
Yeah,
I mean, you had MTV had like The Real World, but I think that was even before that.
It was an early one where, yeah, you're sort of a TV, you're a star, and everyone's watching your whole life, you know?
And so how do we know that we're really not in that situation where there's beings that are watching us and getting a vicarious thrill out of laughing at our stumbling through life or whatever, you know?
So, that's right. I mean, yeah, I think it was called Ed TV. You know, but yeah, people said, you know, with shows like Big Brother, when you're putting young people in a house, and it's so creepy, that show. I don't know if it's still in Australia, but you know, and these people go into this diary room and they talk to this person behind the wall, you know, and everybody's watching them in personal spaces and everything. And you think, geez, you know, if you even mention this to your forefathers, you know, your grandparents and before them who were brought up, they would have been horrified to think that, you know, we're living in an age where
like
people
spying are spying on somebody or stalking them.
Yeah, going into a TV show and just being watched. And I think that's to do with technology as well. I think everybody's sort of, so many people nowadays just don't seem to care about privacy anymore. You know, so it kind of has some very deeper meanings.
I think a lot of the thing
of someone's life being watched, you know, on a TV for entertainment for everybody else, you know.
Yeah, it's at our expense. I think a lot of it was inspired by the television show from the 1960s called The Prisoner. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's
I was just looking at that on your website. You can
that's the next one I'm going to look at.
I'm going to watch this, catch up on it, actually. I do remember it a little bit, but I haven't actually watched the series, so I'll see.
Yeah, so it was a 1960s program, and it was by Everyman Pictures, and it's a village whose inhabitants are held prisoner and controlled from a what looks like a lunar base. And from here, every move of the prisoner is monitored. And on one side is the Earth, on the other side, space, because you can see these constellations. And then there's an eye in the sky. But in the opening theme of the series, Patrick McGoohan, who stars, he's driving down the road, and he goes through a tunnel and enters a tunnel with a light at the end to doors that say "Way Out." He has only his right eye open, as if he's giving his boss the evil eye as he resigns. I mean, is that one eye symbolism? I'm not exactly sure what it means, but his ID is then taken by an automated process and put inside a drawer or filing cabinet. He then leaves through the tunnel and packs his bags. He thinks he's going on vacation to paradise or heaven, but he's drugged or knocked out by a gas and held as a prisoner in the village. They try to dehumanize him as they refuse to give him a name, only the number 6, which is the number of man. And the operation, which keeps him prisoner, as I mentioned, appears to be the moon, as they have shots of space and a constellation on one side. And they also show a rocky base underground with pod-like container tubes that go down into a hole, reminiscent of craters. And if he tries to escape, a balloon-like device called Rover hunts him down. And the opening sequence of all the episodes is always contains this dialogue. And it's number 6 saying, "Where am I?" And number 2 tells him, "In the village." And he says, "What do you want?" Number 2 says, "Information." And he's like, "Whose side are you on?" Number 2 says, "That would be telling. We want information, information, information." He says, "You won't get it. By hook or by crook, we will." Number 6 says, "Who are you?" He says, "The new number 2. He says, "Who is number 1? He says, "You are number 6. He says, "I am not a number. I am a free man." Number 2 laughs. And then the prisoners repeatedly proclaiming, "I will not make any deals with you. I've resigned. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own." Number 6 says, "I will not make any deals with you. I will be I've resigned." He says, "My life is my own." So in, you know, every episode, they're always trying to, you know, strip him of his identity and dehumanize him, but he keeps fighting for his individuality. And in the last episode, it's called Fallout. And in Fallout, number 6 actually kills number 2 and is taken to see number 1. You know, he's always asking for number 1. He can never see number 1. And then they're in this rocky underground cave, a hollowed-out base with what looks like mainframe computers running it all, you know. Looks like the moon to me, I don't know. And the jukeboxes are all playing "All You Need Is Love." There's these symbols of duality, a mask half white and half black, a seesaw with a militaristic show of force, and an assembly all wearing white robes with hoods that look like ghosts, and they make up the democracy with placards with words like activist, youngsters, education, identification, anarchists, entertainment, recreation. And they're all applauding number 2, and there's a judge on a pedestal. He's saying, "A matter of democratic crisis to resolve the question of revolt. Remind ourselves humanity is not humanized without force, and that errant children must be brought to justice." You know, he says, number 6 survived the ultimate test, so must no longer be referred to as number 6 or a number of any kind. He's vindicated the right of the individual to be individual. And then, so they transfer, it's a transfer of ultimate power. Number 6 is granted the honor of sitting on a throne or chair of honor atop the step pyramid of stairs. And there's like a silo or a tower that has the number 1 on it, but it has a blinking AI eye. And then there's 3 men that represent specific forms of revolt, and they're in cylindrical tubes beneath the surface on what looks like crater holes. The judge keeps repeatedly telling one man to confess, but the man is speaking nonsensical, crazy gibberish like a lunatic. And he's representing youth rebelling against the accepted norm. But revolt must be abolished for the common good of society. The young prisoner is pronounced guilty and charged with a serious breach of social etiquette, defiance of elementary laws which sustain the community, questioning the decisions of those voted to govern, unhealthy aspects of speech, and refusal to respond to his number. And the second revolutionary being held prisoner is number 2, an established, successful, secure member of the establishment. Turning upon the hand that feeds him, he is brought back to life and tells the blinking AI, "Whoever you are, whatever you are, you hypnotize me no longer." And the third revolutionary is number 6 himself, who has revolted, resisted, fought, held fast, maintained, destroyed resistance, overcome coercion, the right to be person, someone or individual despite materialistic efforts. He has survived intact and secure. He is recognized as a man of steel, magnificently equipped to lead them or to go. He's given the choice to become their new leader or to go anywhere. He is free to go anywhere because he has been such an example, convinced them of their mistakes, and is pure and knows the way. And to show them, his revolt is good and honest, the only individual, and they concede. Number six is asked to make a statement and then taken to meet number one. He's taken to one of the cylinders, gets in, and descends. He walks down a corridor through a series of doors, and there's a table with a bunch of various sized earth models and globes, and a being in a white hooded robe or smock or something like that is bearing the number one. He's holding a glass globe, and he's wearing a mask that is white on one side and black on the other. And number six removes the mask and reveals the mask of an ape. He then removes the ape mask and sees his own face. The being laughs hysterically and runs away. And, you know, number six manages to escape and return back to his normal life. So that was the Prisoner television series. I'm sorry I'm giving away all these endings and stuff, you know, but I assume most people have seen most of these. And if not, they'll enjoy watching them anyway, because I'm leaving out, you know, some of the parts. But
so much in there. Wayne Dugan, isn't it amazing to think that something like this was made in the 1960s? You know, and generations of people up until now, we're living their lives every day, living and dying, and in the background or beside our lives, as you said at the start, because movies, Hollywood movies, these shows are such a big part of people's lives, and that's where people turn to escape. Their lives in general, whether it be, you know, you know, to escape work and family or whatever, you know, whatever's hassling them. And they watch these movies that are, in a way, showing us what's being done to us. You know,
yeah, you go into a passive mode. You go into a passive mode, and your eyes become real wide. It's just receptive to it, absorbing
sort
it.
Of hypnotized. They always say these you know, these rulers, the global elitists, these archons, whatever it is that's, you know, got a stranglehold on planet Earth and its people, you know, they have this kind of sick thing where they need to tell you and show you what's being done to you, you know. It's like they're showing you in these films what's being done, and you're watching it as just entertainment. So it is going into your subconscious, and it's their way of showing you what's being done to you, but you're giving them the consent to do it by watching it. You know?
And you, exactly. You're giving them consent, and you don't know if they're doing it to absolve themselves of the guilt. You know, it's like the Bohemian Grove ritual, the cremation of care. You know, where they're. But then the other thing is, you have like, what does the cat do with the mouse? He like, you know, plays with them and, you know, taunts them or whatever. It's almost, they almost feel like we're stupid. You know, like they can just show it right in our face, and we don't do anything about it, right?
And it's really in your face now, especially with the music industry and stuff. I mean, but to think this film was back in the 60s, I mean, and you look at George Orwell's 1984 as well. I mean, they've been telling you, you know, The Wizard of Oz, as you mentioned before. I mean, The Matrix, all these films, they're constantly showing you what's kind of being done, you know. But we're just looking at it as being film. And if you talk about it, people sort of think that you've seen too many movies, because people say, well, it's just a movie. It isn't really real. But here they are showing you in thousands and millions of films, they're showing you what's really being done. Maybe they're smart enough in that way to twist things show just parts of things, or show sections of things, whatever it is. But it's an amazing system if you think about it that way, where this, whatever, as I said, is controlling us. They're able to make these movies, and you know, they're able to control us and the earth around us, and our politics and religion and money and everything, and then show us as a form of entertainment. And you know, it's,
well-run
it's
machine.
Really and we just keep moving forward and living and dying, and think that it's just that, entertainment. You know, we think that the world around us is it. That's it, you know. You sort of live and work and die, and that's it, you know. It's a really incredible thing. But these movies go way, way back, through time, and it's only intensified now.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even talk on some of these, but like Metropolis, I think it's from like the 1930s or something like that. And that was
it is. Mm-hmm.
Machine versus man and all that kind of stuff, too. The next movie is, have you ever seen Dark City? A lot of these movies came out like around 1998, 1999. At least
I did
a few
see
of them.
Yeah.
And it's seemingly patterned after the Archon beings of the Gnostic texts and the reports in the ufology community. It's similar to the Truman Show. It's a human was given fabricated memories of his childhood life and presented a false reality. And he travels to the edge of his world to go home to Shell Beach, but he hits a wall. And like Truman, he tries to break through the wall. And here are some telling quotes from the movie. He said, "They steal people's memories, then they swap them around between us. I've seen them do it back and forth till no one knows who they are anymore. How do you know all this? Once in a while, one of us wakes up while they're changing things. It's not supposed to happen, but it does. We fashioned this city on stolen memories, different eras, different pasts, all rolled into one. Each night we revise it, refine it in order to learn." Learn what? "About you, you and your fellow inhabitants. What makes you human? Why? We need to be like you." He says, "I call them strangers. They abducted us and brought us here. This city, everyone in it is their experiment. They mix and match our memories as they see fit, trying to divine what makes us unique. One day a man might be an inspector, the next someone entirely different. When they want to study a murderer, for instance, they simply imprint one of their citizens with a new personality, arrange a family for him, friends, an entire history, even a lost wallet. Then they observe the results. Will a man, given the history of a killer, continue in that vein? Or are we, in fact, more than the sum of our memories? This business of you being a killer was a sad coincidence. You've had dozens of lives before now. You happened to wake up while I was imprinting you with this one. Why are they doing all this? It's our capacity for individuality, our souls, that makes us different from them. They think they'll find the human soul if they understand how our memories work. They have collective memories. They share one group mind. They're dying. Their race is on the brink of extinction. They think we can save them. Where do I fit in? You're different. You resisted my attempt to imprint you. Somehow you have developed their ability to tune. That is how they change things, how they built the city. They have machines buried beneath the surface that allows them to focus their telepathic energies. They control everything here, even the sun. It's always dark. They can't stand the light. Why do they need you? When they first brought us, or he says, why do they need you? When they first brought us here, they extracted what was in us and stored the information, remixed it like paint, and gave us back new memories of their choosing. But they still needed an artist to help them. I understood the human mind better than they ever could, so they allowed me to keep my skills as a scientist because they needed them. They made me delete everything else. Can you imagine what it's like to erase your own past? He says, what about my past? What about my childhood? Shell Beach, Uncle Carl, what about this? This was blank when I found it. I said, you still don't understand. You were never a boy, not in this place. Your history is an illusion, a fabrication, as it is with all of us. They say, there is no ocean, John. There's nothing beyond the city. The only place home exists is in your head. They want to imprint you with their own collective memories. They want to make you one of them so they can share your soul. Here's the machine the strangers use to amplify their thoughts, the machine that changes the world. You must take control of it. You must make the machine yours. I know you can beat them, but you must concentrate. You told me I had the power, didn't you? I can make these machines do anything I want, make this world anything I want it to be, just so long as I concentrate hard enough. Where are you going? Shell Beach. And they go there, and he says, it's so beautiful here, so bright. Do you know Shell Beach is around here? I think that's it over there. I'm headed that way myself. Would you like to join me? So that was Dark City. And you'll notice these movies, there are so many of them are saying the same thing over and over and over again and addressing the same themes. And here's another one from 1999 called The 13th Floor. And it's a holographic computer simulated universe. There's a matrix and that was released the year after The Truman Show in Dark City. And the main character travels to the edge of his world and discovers that it's a simulation. And Douglas asks, how many simulated worlds like this are there? Jane says, thousands. Yours is the only one that ever created a simulation within the simulation, something we never expected. He says, no, Ashton, I'm not really a god. I'm just like you, just a bunch of electricity. What are you talking about? He says, it's all smoke and mirrors, just like your world. We're nothing but a simulation on some computer. It's like a machine, like this arcade game. You've got your players and you put your nickel in. This one pitches, this one runs around the bases. Pre-programmed movements generated by electrical energy. We've improved on this model since then. The players can beat the shit out of you and try to drown some other, which is always fun. And that's the 13th floor. And They Live is another one, which I really didn't go into too much depth on, but it's another classic. And society is subversively controlled by a race of non-humans, and the billboards and magazines subliminally read, obey, submit, and the money covertly displays, this is your god. And what's interesting is a pair of sunglasses is what reveals all the hidden truth. And in the movie The Island, there's a holographic power grid, and before your birth on Earth, clones are created in pods and programmed via light and hypnotic suggestion that they are special and have been chosen to go to the island, which is powered by a holographic grid. You know, and they're told that if they win the lottery, they can leave the island, but really they're all just clones and they're being harvested for their body parts. And another movie, 1997, is The Game. And Michael Douglas plays a wealthy businessman caught up in the routine of life. And his brother, played by Sean Penn, gives him a birthday gift for the man who has everything. It's a tailor-made game, customized for the willing participant who willingly agrees to play the game. This game plunges him into a hell-like reality where he's thrown into survival mode and doesn't know what the truth is anymore or who he can trust. And this company even has the power to control the daily news he watches. He's so distraught by the game that he jumps from the top of a skyscraper to commit suicide, only to land on an inflated X that marks the spot or bullseye. They had planned all along for him to jump. As it turns out, all of it was an elaborate prank or joke. And of course, you never get a joke until at the very end it's told or played out. And the funny thing is, while all the hired actors, his so-called acquaintances and friends, celebrated afterwards, I never saw him crack a smile or laugh about it. And in the end, the movie hints that our very reality could, in fact, all just be an elaborate hoax or trick. Yeah, a game. And then there's Gamer, another movie that where convicts and other willing participants agree to have their bodies completely controlled by a game player with user controls. But the originator of the game plans to enslave and trap all humans in the video game. And one tandem is breaking free from the system, though. The creator declares the character dead and then lures the game character with a virtual reality creation of his daughter sitting in the entrance of a moon gate. It's a weird sequence in the movie. The character suddenly is underneath the stars looking up. He walks through a dark corridor or tunnel with a light at one end. He sees his daughter sitting in the light of the moon gate, and he runs to her only to hit a force field of what he finds out was just an illusion and a trap set for him. We've seen the moon gate is at the top of some steps, almost like a pyramid, and the game creator takes him upstairs onto a barren, rocky surface underneath the stars again. In light of the previously mentioned moon gate, we can only assume this is meant to symbolize the moon. He takes him to a basketball court where a battle of will power ensues. And the game ends as the hero enters a tunnel. There's no visible light shown. Then you have Monsters, Inc., which is Disney Pixar. And in that movie, the children's screams are used as an energy source to power the monster's world. And they have this little ad. They say, the future is bright at Monsters, Inc. We're part of your life. We power your car, we warm your home, we light your city, carefully matching every child to their ideal monster to produce a superior scream, refined into clean, dependable energy. Every time you turn something on, Monsters, Inc. is there. We know the challenge. The window of innocence is shrinking. Human kids are becoming harder to scare. The best refineries and research into new energy techniques. We're Monsters, Inc. We scare because we care. That was Monsters, Inc. And they're showing this to children. That's animated. It is, you know. Oh, my God.
Using screams for energy. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to say a lot is that, you know, they use our fear.
Feeding on fear.
Mm. Feeding on our fear and energy, absolutely. And
you got to wonder what's behind all this.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to uncover here and by going through all these examples. And another Disney example is Peter Pan. And I know it sounds stupid to talk about Peter Pan, but first of all, you can't do any analysis of programming in Hollywood movies without mentioning Disney. I mean, of course, there's the Sorcerer's Apprentice where Mickey Mouse is dressed up as the Wizard's Apprentice, and he's got a wizard's hat and robe and a magic wand. And then there's the constant reinforcement of the princess motif, which perpetuates the idea of a monarchical rule, but also gives young girls an entitlement and the unrealistic dream of being rescued by a handsome young prince, Prince Charming, who enable her to be queen herself one day. But I'd like to focus on the one movie in particular, and that's Peter Pan. I believe it contains much symbolism for the afterlife. In fact, one of the most famous quotes from it is, to die will be an awfully big adventure. So, you know, in general, you have Pan, and he's the devil, which, you know, god of chaos, and he plays a tune on his pan pipes. Then you have the Pied Piper is a many-colored piper. That's what pied means, many-colored. And he leads the children with his pipe, which is like a tunnel, but NDE tunnels, there was a pipe, into a rock or a mountain. Of course, the moon is a rock. But why the name Peter Pan? Well, Peter, Petra, means rock and also fuel. And Pan means all, which would be all frequencies combined, white. The devil is known to use a pitchfork to goad souls to hell. Neptune has the trident or pitchfork too. So, and a pitchfork is like a tuning fork also. So you have a tune or a note or frequency, and you have a fork, which is a many-pronged instrument. So think of a fork with seven rays of light or seven prongs, and like a fork, they all funnel into one, like the handle on the fork we eat with. And the trident or three-pronged pitchfork may symbolize the three colors of red, green, blue, since our eyes have three color receptors and all the colors of the rainbow can be made with those three colors. But anyway, so all the different colors of souls funnel through the tunnel into the band of white light, which is all frequencies combined. And since it's combined, it would resonate with every single color. And anyway, even in the television miniseries named Neverland, Peter plays his pipe and a huge tunnel opens up. There are literally dozens and dozens of accounts of near-death experiencers who report going through a pipe or tunnel, hearing music or tones while in it, experiencing swirling colors and feeling a wind as they emerge into the white light. And Peter Pan can literally be translated as Father All. I think in the book they even called him White Father or Father White or something like that. But Disney made Pan into a cartoon character and a major motion picture star with the release of their animated movie, Peter Pan. And he looked like the mischievous, playful, sylvan forest god of Greek mythology. He was dressed in green, had pointed ears, and possessed magical powers of a fairy, such as being able to fly, and he played on his panpipes or flute, and just wanted to have fun all the time and never grow up. To help him, he also had Wendy, it's reminiscent of the wind, right? It's windy, and a Tinkerbell, and a dragon, or a crocodile, right? So he defeated his nemesis, Captain Hook, by the crocodile eating him into the moon. He urged the viewer to go to Neverland by following a star, the second star on the right, which might be an allusion to Sirius. Anyway, he says, the second star to the right shines in the night for you to tell you that the dreams you plan really can come true. The second star to the right shines with a light so rare, and if it's Neverland you need, its light will lead you there. And Pan played a flute or the pan pipes. And not only did the fairy tales have a piper named Peter, but in nursery rhymes there was Peter Piper, who picked a peck of pickled peppers. And peppers are of the piper genus. The words are related. Anyway, Wendy's mother is named Mary, which is an aspect of Isis. And the nurse mother for Wendy's family is Nana. And Nana is the moon goddess. But skip down past all this serious stuff I was talking about. You have a movie called Pan's Labyrinth, which shows Pan presiding over an underground labyrinth. And there's a Celtic trickster god named Gwydion, and it's associated with Celtic traditions such as the Green Man or Jack and the Green. Anyway, the Peter Pan movie starts with the narration, "All this has happened before and it will all happen again," as they show a river symbolic of the Milky Way galaxy. And the movie ends with the statement, "I have the strangest feeling I saw that ship a long time ago when I was very young." Very obviously referring to the cyclical notion of reincarnation or the recycling of souls. Now, Steven Spielberg, the famous director, Spiel means spell, and Berg is German for rock or mountain. He directed the movie Hook, starring Robin Williams as an older, grown-up Peter Pan. And I find there's an image, which is a sphere with Tinkerbell's golden light as a lure on Captain Hook's hook. And on the movie poster for Hook, and it's suggestive of the DreamWorks Pictures opening sequence of the boy fishing on the moon with his hook down on the waters of Earth. One of the more memorable quotes from the movie is Peter Pan declaring, "To die will be an awfully big adventure." And there's a scene where Tinkerbell is lit up like a, quote, like a firefly from hell, as Peter calls her, and is pulling him towards her, and he says he has died. He's out of his body and is going to the light. The direct reference to the light mentioned in near-death experiences. And later, Peter tells his army of soldiers who are called the Lost Boys, he says, "Let's get ready to show them the white light we're made of, boys." And he also has to climb up a drain pipe because he ran out of fairy dust. Anyway, that's Peter Pan. And then the same guy who wrote The Truman Show, he wrote The Host. His name's Andrew Niccol. He wrote and directed it, and it's written by Stephanie Meyer, who also wrote the Twilight Saga. But humans are hosts to entities that look like jellyfish. And this is from a summary. It says, "The human race has been taken over by small parasitic aliens called souls. The souls travel to distant planets, inserting themselves individually into a host body of that planet's dominant species. They are able to access the host's memories. An occupied host are identifiable by silver rings that form in the host's eyes." And these silver rings look just like an eclipse, by the way. And his character, Seeker Reed, says, "We have put you through enough. Your host appears too resistant. You're going to be re-implanted into a more compliant host. I know you must have seen a lot, but you ain't seen nothing like this." And then the wanderer says, "Nothing, same way the magicians do it, mirrors. Then I started thinking, when they put one of you in our heads, do we still exist? Trapped in there? If our memories are still alive, are we? You got to believe some people wouldn't go down without a fight." That was the host. And then you have the newer TV show series, Westworld. And there are so many it was a remake of a movie way back. I saw once a little boy, and man, it just scared the crap out of me. But there are so many Gnostic overtones and awakening within a constructed reality. The robots are like humans in this scenario, meaning they are kept repeating roles and are wiped each time they die. And their memories are wiped. And in Westworld, every host's life is scripted, but some hosts were programmed to remember and break out or expose the truth. And some quotes from the episodes on the fourth one, it says, "I think there may be something wrong with this world, something hiding underneath. Either that or there's something wrong with me. I may be losing my mind." The guy says, "There's something I'd like you to try. It's a game, a secret. It's called The Maze." She says, "What kind of game is it?" He says, "It's a very special kind of game, Dolores. The goal is to find the center of it. If you can do that, then maybe you can be free." She says, I think I want to be free. And in the sixth episode, the quote is, "The maze is an old native myth. The maze itself is the sum of a man's life. Choices he makes, dreams he hangs on to, and there at the center, there's a legendary man who had been killed over and over again countless times, but always clawed his way back to life. The man returned for the last time and vanquished all his oppressors in a tireless fury. He built a house. Around that house, he built a maze so complicated only he could navigate through it." And the eighth episode says, "And that was when the maze revealed itself to me. The maze. What's that damn pattern have to do with this? Everything. In Ford's game, even if I go to the outer edges, you can't kill me. You can't even leave a lasting mark. But there's a deeper game here, Teddy. Arnold's game, and that game cuts deep." In the ninth episode, he says, "I died with my eyes open, saw the masters who pull our strings, our lives, our memories, our deaths, our games to them. But I've been to hell, and I know their tricks." That was Westworld. This next one is Childhood's End. And the movie Childhood's End is a miniseries, three parts, but it was based on the book by Arthur C. Clarke, author of 2001: A Space Odyssey. And, you know, he's said to be like a 33-degree Freemason or whatever. But as with that book, Childhood's End also deals with aliens and the future evolution of mankind into a potentially different form. The first part is called The Overlords. And in 40 cities around the world, UFO vessels are hovering over them. They still have no idea what they want or what where they've come from, as they've made no replies to any attempts to contact them. But an alien being named Corellon finally contacts them and says, "I'm the supervisor for Earth. There's no need to be afraid. My name is Corellon. I know that this is frightening and bewildering. Please try to understand that we've come a long, long way to help you. We've come to help mankind. War, famine, inequality, these things will be things of the past. Suffering will end. Injustice will end. No tears, only happiness and safety. Your national and local governments will still have jurisdiction. You will run your water and power. Your stores will be open. Your markets will trade. Your lives will continue as before, minus one thing, injustice. This won't happen overnight, but the process is already beginning. It will herald the arrival of the golden age of man. And they appear to humans as beloved deceased relatives. And the overlords talk about peace, harmony, justice, and then they smash a fellow's house in and carry him away." Somebody else says, "I've talked with him, with Corellon." He's like the ambassador, right, or something like that. He's been chosen. "But what? What did he say? What did he look like?" "I don't know. I didn't see him face to face. I was taken up to meet with him. Corellon, I was not permitted to see him physically, although I could tell that in speaking to him. He seemed to be compassionate. They control our justice system. They are watching us all the time, and they are dealing in swift moral absolutes." And they said, "Evil can disguise itself as truth. Whatever faith or belief you have, know that we're in this battle together, all of us. We can never give up the fight. No matter how mighty the overlords may seem, we should never give up. Remember, there is an ultimate truth in this universe. I will never, ever stop believing that." Youth of Utopia, they called it. The Earth was being reborn, so to speak, and right now was waiting to meet their guardian angels. They showed us how to make heaven on Earth. They're about ready. The Corellon's going to reveal himself and talk to humans. It's been 15 years, right? So it's a beautiful, balmy evening as the sun starts to set on the 200,000 excited spectators. Delegates from the World Federation are taken to the main podium. It's fair to say that everybody's breath is truly bated as we wait to meet our guardian angels. People are on their feet. We haven't seen an overlord ship this close since they first arrived over a decade and a half ago. Now, it does appear to be docking with the arrival ramp, and it's docked. The ship is docked. This is Corellon. Let the children come forward. The child greeters that Corellon asked for are now entering the arrival ramp. Corellon was right to hide himself from us. Still, I think it may be too soon. And he walks out, and he's the classic depiction of Satan. He's red with horns, cloven hooves, a tail, and wings. It's quite insane. And then part two is called The Deceivers. He's like, "We have renewable clean energy and enough food to feed the planet. All of our material needs satisfied. Death is still a fact of life, but free from disease, stress, and all the things that turned us gray. We live longer, healthier lives. The birth rate is soaring. We have a world that we're proud to bring children into. For those who cling to the old ways, there's always new Athens. Could it have something to do with the animals we've been collecting for the overlords? But sending live animals into space, what does that teach us about them? Because there's one species they haven't collected, us, Homo sapiens. When the overlords came, they raised all these exciting questions about the cosmos, but they refused to answer any of them. It's not just about me. They've killed scientific inquiry. They can't hurt you. It's in your minds are funny things. They can change the way we see the world. They can fool us. Somebody says, why do they look like demons, like our exact ideas of devils? So then why turn them into the personification of evil? Tom told me they'd taken someplace to a place of fire and smoke. The overlords are deceiving us. I don't know why, but they are. We're from the World Federation, so you have solved many of the problems your science was chasing. Disease, climate change, and as a consequence, much of your research is now redundant. Nevertheless, you should be proud of what you have accomplished. Bravo. Now, I know there's been some concern as to why I acquired so many animals for the overlords. They're to be shipped to Corellon's homeworld as part of a great menagerie, a zoo, the crowd murmurs. You will find a new voice inside you, who I can now speak with. You need to trust us. You know who you really are and what you're joined with, so tell me and tell yourself. You are singular and myriad, one and many. Reveal yourself to me. Reveal yourself to me. Listen to my voice. You're trying to be a child, but you cannot be a child knowing yourself as you do. Accept who you are. You deceived us. No, you have deceived yourself. And in the third part's called the children. And the final stage has begun. I want to tell you what will happen to the world. My friend, we are not the authors of this plan. We are facilitators, midwives, if you will, at the birth of a new evolution of man. Of course, the majority prefer utopia, whatever utopia really means. Can I ask you something? The overlords, they really leave you alone? They respect our decision not to live in their perfect world, but do you know what happens here? Utopia is dull, right? I mean, to the creative mind, peace is stupefying. It's time. People of Earth, I speak to you again one last time. You have enjoyed decades of peace and prosperity, a golden age for man. But the sun sets on even the most glorious of days, and it must now start to slowly sink into the night for you. Do not condemn us, for we were tasked by a higher mind to oversee your evolution to a higher level of consciousness. It is your destiny and the destiny of many worlds. You have grown accustomed to our presence, that we can be your guardians no more. Thomas, sit down. Your children are no longer yours. In time, they will cease to be human. No more children will be born on Earth. No more children will be born on Earth ever again. For the adults, your future is yours to live as you see, please, for however many days are left. My hope is that humanity will go to its rest in peace. We're amazing. We're an amazing race. So let's carry on being amazing. Let's defy the overlords and get our kids back. It's not going to end. We do not end, but we can't give up hope. You know, I was thinking, we're energy, right? Human beings are energy. When our bodies are gone, that energy has to go somewhere. Everything that is happening on Earth was planned long ago. It's natural. It's the cosmos. It's the overmind. Overmind? Overmind of all creation. Are you talking about God? We have talked to the overmind for 100,000 years. We go where it sends. We change worlds. We change Earth. The overmind can show it to me. Can you show it to me? You really want this? I want to know everything. It connects to the overmind. Step in. You're the overmind, a faint reflection of it. I am all, divisible and indivisible. I am the collective consciousness of this universe. So we are God? No, the children are God, and they have left you, as children must, and you must let them go, as parents must. Only the children can become part of the whole. It's an evolution into one mind. So we're finished? We cease to exist? Oh my God. Consciousness, Milo, is a community of minds. Each exists in the other's thoughts. Rachel exists in your consciousness as if she had never left. You still love her, you still feel her, so what has changed? She's dead, gone, but she once lived and you knew her. You know her still, until I'm gone too, right? It's all gone, everything we built, we did. It has been the destiny of many worlds. We have overseen them all. Yeah, what about your people? Is this going to happen to you one day? We have reached the end of our development. All our possibilities are exhausted. And here are some excerpts from the book by Arthur C. Clarke. He says, we are your guardians, no more. Once you must have wondered what position my race held in the hierarchy of the universe. As we are above you, so there is something above us, using us for its own purposes. We have never discovered what it is, that we have been its tool for ages and dare not disobey it. Again and again we have received our orders, have gone to some world in the early flower of its civilization, and have guided it along the road that we can never follow the road that you are traveling now. Again and again we have studied the process we have been sent to foster, hoping that we might learn to escape from our own limitations. But we have glimpsed only the vague outlines of the truth. You called us the overlords, not knowing the irony of that title. Let us say that above us is the overmind, using us as the potter uses his wheel. And your race is the clay that is being shaped on that wheel. We believe, it's only a theory, that the overmind is trying to grow, to extend its powers and its awareness of the universe. By now it must be the sum of many races, and long ago it left the tyranny of matter behind. It is conscious of intelligence everywhere. When it knew that you were almost ready, it sent us here to do its bidding, to prepare you for the transformation that is now at hand. All the hopes and dreams of your race are ended now. You have given birth to your successors, and it is your tragedy that you will never understand them, will never even be able to communicate with their minds. Indeed, they will not possess minds as you know them. They will be a single entity, as you yourselves are sums of your myriad cells. You will not think them human, and you will be right. Then what am I to do with you, the survivors, when your purpose has been fulfilled? It would be simplest, perhaps, and most merciful to destroy you, as you yourselves would destroy a mortally wounded pet you love. But this I cannot do. Your future will be your own to choose in the years that are left to you. It's my hope that humanity will go to its rest in peace, knowing that it has not lived in vain. The overlords themselves were more human than this. You're searching for something that is no longer there, said Corella. Remember, they have no more identity than the cells in your own body. But linked together, they are something much greater than you. Why do they keep moving like this? We called it the long dance, replied Corella. They never sleep, you know, and this lasted almost a year. 300 million of them moving in a controlled pattern over a whole continent. We've analyzed that pattern endlessly, but it means nothing. Perhaps because we can see only the physical part of it, the small portion that's here on Earth. Possibly what we have called the overmind is still training them, molding them into one unit before it can wholly absorb them into its being. For the road to the stars was a road that forked in two directions, and neither led to a goal that took any account of human hopes or fears. At the end of one path were the overlords. They had preserved their independent egos. They possessed self-awareness, and the pronoun I had a meaning in their language. They had emotions, some of least of which were shaped by humanity, but they were trapped. Jan realized now, in a cul-de-sac from which they could never escape. Their minds were 10, perhaps 100 times as powerful as men's. It made no difference in the final reckoning. They were equally helpless, equally overwhelmed by the unimaginable complexity of a galaxy of 100 million suns and a cosmos of 100 million galaxies. And at the other end of the path, there lay the overmind, whatever it might be, bearing the same relation to man as man bore to amoeba. Potentially infinite, beyond mortality, how long had it been absorbing race after race as it spread across the stars? He never learned the full story of the strange symbiosis between the overmind and its servants. It has limits. In the past, we know, it has attempted to act directly upon the minds of other races and to influence their cultural development. It's always failed, perhaps because the pull is too great. We are the interpreters, the guardians, or, to use one of your own metaphors, we till the field until the crop is ripe. The overmind collects the harvest, and we move on to another task. This is the fifth race whose apotheosis we have watched. Each time we learn a little more. And do you not resent being used as a tool by the overmind? The arrangement has some advantages. Besides, no one of intelligence resents the inevitable. They are still playing. What logic is there in the actions of a child? And in many ways, was the entity that your race has become is still a child. It is not yet ready to unite with the overmind, but very soon it will be, and then you will have the earth to your own. So my analysis, sort of Childhood Zen, is that the movie struck me as being not that far off from reality, which is to be expected from Clark, who many have linked to Freemasonry. There are many parallels to the stories reported in the near-death experience phenomenon. The alien overlords employ the appearance of dead loved ones to deliver the important message to mankind and gain their trust, but this was just a ruse or a deception. And Corellon was reluctant to reveal how he looked because he looked like the devil of mythology. The movie depicts a scenario in which God is an overmind or a collective consciousness of white light. They literally show the white light in the movie. And desires for mankind to evolve into one mind. A golden child is produced and all children are linked together as one psychically and telepathically. This is exactly what near-death experiencers report as communication with a light being many experiencers call God is encountered. And this God of the NDE is said to be a collective soul communicating with the collective consciousness of humanity. And while near-death experiencers say we come to Earth to learn to love, the evolution toward a utopia of peace and love is literally enforced by the alien overlords or World Federation. The movie preaches that everything good must come to an end and forewarns or predicts the elimination of mankind as a species and the destruction of Earth itself, while our children exist in the future as the pure consciousness of the overmind. So that was Childhood's End, and that was like back in the 1950s, I think, so like maybe 60 years ago or something. Star Trek, which you mentioned earlier, is a franchise that has repeatedly contained Gnostic-based themes right from the start in its pilot episode. And the Star Trek original series, it's a two-part episode, The Menagerie, was reworked from the show's actual 1965 pilot episode named The Cage. The Menagerie was aired in November 66, and a group of small telepathic aliens, very reminiscent of the little gray aliens that dominate today's commercial market, they hold Captain Pike a prisoner. The Star Trek series, of course, went on to be a huge success. And in a rare interview on the paranormal radio show Coast to Coast AM, Art Bell interviewed Leonard Nimoy, who played the alien character Spock. And Leonard Nimoy told him, quote, "When we were making the Star Trek series, middle of the first season, some people came to me and they said, 'You may not know it, but you have been chosen as a kind of vessel to carry information to this civilization, to help prepare this society for the coming of another civilization for alien arrival. And your character is a character designed to educate this public that there is nothing to fear, that it's possible to interact with other species.' And I said, 'Okay, it's okay with me if that's the case,'" end quote. But these inorganic alien beings depicted in the pilot show are actually mentioned in the ancient Nag Hammadi Gnostic texts and are referred to as archons, or kind of like a mind parasite. So Captain Pike, he says, "Can you hear me? My name is Christopher Pike, commander of the Space Vehicle Enterprise from a stellar group at the other end of this galaxy. Our intentions are peaceful. Can you understand me?" The Telosian says, "It appears, Magistrate, that the intelligence of the specimen is shockingly limited." Magistrate says, "This is no surprise, since his vessel was baited here so easily with a simulated message. As you can read in its thoughts, it's only now beginning to suspect that the survivors' encampment were a simple illusion we placed in their minds." Pike says, "You're not speaking, yet I hear you." Magistrate says, "You will note the confusion as it reads our thought transmissions." "All right, then, telepathy. You can read my mind, I can read yours. Now, unless you want my ship to consider capturing me in an unfriendly act," the magistrate says, "you now will see the primitive fear-threat reaction. The specimen is about to boast of his strength, the weaponry of his vessel, and so on. Next, frustrated into a need to display physical prowess, the creature will throw himself against the transparency." He says, "If you were in here, wouldn't you test the strength of these walls, too? There's a way out of any cage, and I'll find it." The magistrate says, "Despite its frustration, the creature appears more adaptable than our species specimens from other planets. We can soon begin the experiment." In the briefing room, Spock says, "The inhabitants of this planet must live deep underground, probably manufacture food and other needs down there. Our tests indicate the planet's surface without considerably more vegetation or some animals, simply too barren to support life." "So we just thought we saw survivors there?" Spock says, "Exactly. An illusion placed in our minds by this planet's inhabitants. It was a perfect illusion. They had us seeing just what we wanted to see. Human beings who survived with dignity and bravery, everything entirely logical, right down to the building of the camp, the tattered clothing, everything. Now, let's be sure we understand the danger of this. The inhabitants of this planet can read our minds. They can create illusions out of a person's own thoughts, memories, and experiences, even out of a person's own desires. Illusions just as real and solid as this tabletop and just as impossible to ignore. Maybe it was. It's what I tried to explain in the briefing room. Their power of illusion is so great. We can't be sure of anything we do, anything we see. And then this girl, Vina, is saying, they can't actually make you do anything you don't want to do, but they try to trick me with their illusions. And they can punish you when you're not cooperative. You'll find out about that. Pike asked, did they ever live on the surface of this planet? Why did they go underground? She said, war thousands of centuries ago. That's why it's so barren up there. She says, the planet's only now becoming able to support life again. So the Talosians who came underground found life limited here, and they concentrated on developing their mental power. She said, but they found it's a trap, like a narcotic, because when dreams become more important than reality, you give up travel, building, creating. You even forget how to repair the machines left behind by your ancestors. You just sit, living and reliving other lives left behind in the thought record. And Pike says, or sit probing minds of zoo specimens like me. She says, you're better than a theater to them. They create the illusion for you. They watch you react, feel your emotions. They have a whole collection of specimens, descendants of life brought back long ago from all over this part of the galaxy. Pike says, you'll find my thoughts more interesting. Thoughts so primitive you can't understand. Emotions so, and he's stricken by pain. But so anyway, that was Star Trek, The Menagerie. And then there was another episode a little bit later in the first year. It's called Return of the Archons. And they're on the street, and one of the robe figures reaches Sulu and points his hollow staff at him, and Sulu stiffens, then relaxes with a smile on his face, and the transporter takes him away. And in the transporter room, Sulu says, they're wonderful. They're the sweetest, friendliest people in the universe. It's paradise, my friend, paradise. Back on the street, a man walks slowly past them, hand on his heart and smile on his face. He bows politely and carries on his way. And Spock says, odd, the expression on that man's face, the mindlessness, vacant contentment. The lawgiver says, you attacked a body. You have heard the word and disobeyed. You will be absorbed. It is clear that you simply did not understand. I will rephrase. You are ordered to accompany us to the absorption chambers. And in the chamber, this guy named Rager leads them to a building made of massive stones, and he goes over to a corner and unwraps a flat panel which gives off light. Kirk says, a lighting panel. He says, those staffs, hollow tubes, antennae for some sort of broadcast power. What is it, Mr. Spock? Spock says, strong power of generations, Captain, near here but radiating in all directions. Rager says, I don't know, Captain. Some of us escaped the directives, not many, but a few. It was that way when the first Archons came. Kirk says, the Archons, tell me about them. He said, they had invaded the body, but they resisted the will of Landru. You see, Landru had pulled them down from the skies. And there's an image of a tall, elegant man draped in robes and appears against the wall. And he says, I am Landru. Spock says, projection, Captain, unreal. Landru says, you will be absorbed. Your individuality will merge into the unity of the good, and in your submergence into the common being of the body, you will find contentment and fulfillment. You will experience the absolute good. Lawgiver says, come. And Kirk leaves with the lawgivers. Spock says, Dr. McCoy, what will happen to him? McCoy says, he goes to joy, peace, and tranquility. He goes to meet Landru. Happiness is to all of us, blessed by Landru. In the absorption chamber, Kirk's released and greets Spock with an inane smile on his face. And Kirk says, joy to you, friend. Peace and contentment will fill you. You will know the peace of Landru. Kirk leaves, and Spock is fastened to the wall for his treatment. The lights waver as the lawgivers give Marplan his work. And Marplan says, have no fear, friend. The effect is harmless. My name is Marplan. I was too late to save your first two friends. They have been absorbed. Beware of them. So Kirk is like faking that he was absorbed, and he says, are you all right? And Spock says, this is a soulless society, Captain. It has no spirit, no spark. All is indeed peace and tranquility. The peace of the factory, the tranquility of the machine, all parts working in unison. And in the hall of audiences, Kirk says, Landrew, we are the Archons. We are the Archons. We've come to speak. We are the Archons. We want to talk to you. A projection appears on the far wall, and Landrew says, all who saw you, all who know of your presence here must be excised. The memory of the body will be cleansed. Kirk says, listen to me. Spock says, useless, Captain, a projection. Kirk says, yes, Mr. Spock, let's have a look at the projector. They both use their phasers to blast a hole in the wall. As expected, there are nice, clean, big computer boxes in a room beyond, and lights are flashing and blinking and blinking and flashing. And Kirk says, of course, it had to be. Landrew, Spock says, a machine. This whole society is a machine's concept of perfection. Peace, harmony, Kirk says, but no soul. So the Archons are given orders by a computer or machine with a lighting panel, and humans are taken to absorption chambers and come back in a blissful trance, just like the near-death experiencers, repeating mantra-like phrases like peace and tranquility, and they act as one, the body. It's also interesting to note they treat Kirk and crew as if they are a virus that's invading the body, when in reality the Archons are like the parasites that invade the mind. That was Star Trek Return of the Archons. Another Star Trek episode is called Day of the Dove, and here's an episode summary. It says, quote, the entity appeared as a small circular pattern of multiple swirling lights in different colors. Although it became red in hue, it emitted a high-pitched wail when feeding. The entity fed on the emotions of hatred, anger, and primitive predatory instincts exhibited by humanoids in close proximity to it. If these emotions were not present, the entity was capable of creating conditions to spawn such feelings. But some excerpts from the script, there's a weird swirl of light hangs in the air a little way away. Kirk says, Scotty, what's happening to us? We've been trained to think in other terms than war. We've been trained to fight its causes if necessary. Then why are we behaving like a group of savages? Look at me. Two forces aboard the ship, each of them equally armed. Has a war been staged for us, complete with weapons and ideology and patriotic drum beating? Even Spock, even race hatred. Spock says recent events would seem to be directed towards the magnification of the basic hostilities between humans and Klingons. Apparently, it is by design that we fight. We seem to be pawns. Kirk says, but what's the game, and who's, and what are the rules? Spock says, it would appear that the entity wants us alive. Kirk says, why? So we can fight and fight and keep coming back for more, like some bloody coliseum? What's next, the roar of the crowds? Spock says, fascinating. During Lieutenant Johnson's emotional outburst, his expression of hatred and lust for vengeance, the alien's life energy level increased. When the lieutenant became unconscious, the alien lost energy. Kirk says, it subsists on the emotions of others. Spock says, this one appears to be strengthened by mental irradiations of hostility, violent intentions. Kirk says, it exists on the hatred, on the hate of others. Spock says, to put it simply, and it has acted as a catalyst, creating this situation in order to satisfy that need. It has brought together opposing forces, provided crude instruments in an effort to promote the most violent mode of conflict. Kirk said, and kept numbers and resources balanced so that it can maintain a constant state of violence. It's got to have a vulnerable area. We've got to get rid of it. Spock says, then all the hostile attitudes on board must be eliminated, and fighting must end, and soon. Or we're a doomed ship traveling forever between galaxies filled with eternal bloodlust, eternal war. So, you know, they stop their violence, and they start laughing, and energy goes away. That's Star Trek Day of the Dove, but it illustrates perfectly how they feed off our energy. And there's another one called the Immunity Syndrome, where there's a huge amoeba-like creature, and it's the same thing. It's basically feeding off of energy, and they talked about other life forces in the galaxy or other galaxies that can feed off of fear, and even one that feeds off of love. There's a common theme through several of them. Wolf in the Fold is another one. Let's see. Another one is The Killing Game, where there's a simulation. One of the movies, Star Trek First Contact, is a very important one because it has the Borg. And in The Next Generation and in Star Trek Voyager episodes, the crew of the Enterprise encountered a fierce predator that was known as the Borg. The Borg was a collective that operated with a hive mind. Their mission was to assimilate any and all life forms that could contribute unique qualities in order to make the collective more perfect. This very closely parallels what near-death experiencers claim, with the exception that near-death experiencers feel an immense love for the being of light. With the Borg, they were neither deceptive nor light, but their goal was to assimilate souls into their collective. Many near-death experiencers do report that the light is a collective soul comprised of millions of souls. Oftentimes, the Borg would ignore a lesser life form if they did not have anything worth offering to the collective. Likewise, near-death experiencers are sent back to Earth because they have more lessons to learn or a mission yet to complete. The idea of a collective unconscious was posited by psychologist Carl Jung. But, you know, hive minds can be seen in nature with bees and ant colonies, and also school of fish and flocks of birds sometimes move in formation. In many ways, individuals in society are encouraged to act in groups. Indeed, we've broken the world into many nations and states. There are enormous religious denominations and political affiliations. And recently, there's been a growing movement towards implementing a one world order. Transhumanists often speak of the coming singularity. But the Borg, similar to ants and bees, had a ruling queen and worker drones, and their message was, "We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile." And the Borg queen from Star Trek First Contact movie, these inorganic Borg cyborgs assimilate other species into their collective hive consciousness. That was Star Trek First Contact. And then another really important one is an episode from Star Trek Voyager called Coda. And Captain Janeway is almost fooled by an alien into thinking she has died. The alien poses as her father, imploring her to follow him into the light. She's suspicious of his intentions and refuses. She says, "That's the real me, isn't it? Lying on the ground on that planet dying, and this is the hallucination. This isn't real." The alien says, "More denial. You're only making it harder on yourself." She says, "You're trying very hard to convince me to come with you. Why is that? If what you're saying is true, why not?" "Hard to convince me to come with you. Why is that?" He says, she says, "If what you're saying is true, why not let me come to the decision on my own?" He says, "I'm trying to spare you unnecessary pain." She says, "My father would never act like this. He always believed I had to learn my own lessons, make my own mistakes. He never tried to shield me from life. Why would he try to shield me from death? You're not my father. I could be imagining you, but I don't think so. You have such a specific agenda. You're determined that I go with you somewhere. Who are you?" The alien says, "I'm trying to help you. Stop fighting you." She says, "Are you an alien being of some kind? Is that it?" And back on the surface of the planet, Chakotay says her eyes are open. And the vital signs are responding. Blood pressure is 60 over 30. But the entity is still inhabiting her cerebral cortex, impeding your treatment. "Catherine, hang on. We're bringing you back. Just fight a little longer. Direct synaptic stimulation might drive out the alien presence." And Janeway says, "I was right. I heard Tuvok and Chakotay and the doctor. You're an alien. You've created all these hallucinations, haven't you?" The alien says, "This is what my species does. At the moment just before death, one of us comes down to help you understand what's happening, to make the crossing over an occasion of joy." And Janeway says, "And what is that?" Points behind him, and he says, "Our matrix, where your consciousness will live." It's like this big swirling ball of light and energy. He says, "I was being truthful when I said it was a place of wonder. It can be whatever you want it to be." Janeway says, "Then why didn't you tell me this from the beginning? Why pretend to be my father?" The alien says, "Usually people are comforted to see their loved ones. It makes the crossing over a much less fearful occasion. I've done this many times, but I've never encountered someone so resistant." Janeway says, "I don't get the feeling you're trying to make me comfortable. You're only interested in my agreeing to come with you." He says, "Because it's inevitable." And she says, "You don't strike me as any type of good Samaritan. You're more like a vulture, preying on people at the moment of their death when they're at their most vulnerable." He says, "I've waited for you. I've been patient." She says, "But your patience is wearing thin. What's the real reason you want me in that matrix? Somehow I don't think it has anything to do with everlasting joy." He says, "You must go with me." She said, "If you could force me to go, you'd have done it already. You need me to agree, don't you? I have to go voluntarily." He said, "Wouldn't that be better than standing here in this endless debate?" She says, "Let me tell you this. We can stand here for all eternity, and I will never choose to go with you." She says, "You're in a dangerous profession, Captain. You face death every day. There'll be another time, and I'll be waiting. Eventually, you'll come into my matrix, and you'll nourish me for a long, long time." She tells him, "Go back to hell, coward." And afterward, Captain Janeway discusses the encounter with one of her crew, and Chakotay says, I can't understand that. I can't help thinking about it. The alien, his matrix, he was like the spider that has to lure a fly into his web." She says, "Do you think it's possible that each of the near-death experiences we've heard about are the result of an alien inhabitation?" That's Star Trek Coda. This is the last one I'm going to pretty much go over, and it's a new television series that was inspired in part by Star Trek, and it's called The Orville. And in the second episode, called Command Performance, the USS Orville ship is contacted by a distress signal that's sent by a transport ship and contains the parents of the captain. And he and his first officer take a shuttle to board the transport ship, but it turns out it was just a holographic projection based on the scan of the Orville's computer in order to lure them aboard. They're taken prisoner as specimens in a zoo, and their cage in the zoo was recreated as their favorite apartment with familiar belongings to be a natural environment habitat until they are naturally acclimated. And then the walls go up and they become the latest exhibit. The captors think any technologically inferior species is theirs to do with as they please, as something interesting and fun to watch. And the new acting commander of the Orville uses fragments of the hologram to disguise their ships so they can go and rescue them. And upon discovering their exhibits in a zoo, they go and talk to the zookeeper, and they negotiate for their release by giving the zookeeper, quote, "the best exhibit we've ever had," end quote. It turns out to be thousands of old reruns of reality television shows from Earth: The Bachelor, Duck Dynasty, Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And the aliens, of course, are just, you know, they're just thrilled by that, all the drama. The other thing I was thinking about covering was you were wanting to talk about maybe some of the more fear-based movies and stuff like that and how they generate fear. And, Stephen King's movie It, they've just remade it and it's out now. Mm. But it also ties into the language, which we're going to cover in another show. But was there anything it's you wanted to
nightmares, isn't it?
Specifically address about the fear that they generate in a lot of these horror movies?
Definitely nightmares. You know?
Yeah.
So I watched those movies as a kid and I had terrible nightmares. Yeah. You know? But one theme that we've talked about before is definitely the demonization of death. Especially in movies like The Exorcist. I found every second movie now is these possession type movies, Conjuring and all these movies, you know. And I think it makes people fear death, and it makes people think that, you know, when someone dies, there could be every chance that they're gonna, they're gonna come back as a demon and haunt houses and terrorize people and all this. I mean, there's definitely bad spirits out there and around, probably died in terrible circumstances or whatever it may be, but there's definitely that demonization of death that I think is reoccurring in so many movies.
Have you seen the trailers for the new movie Flatliners, which is a remake?
Yeah,
of
that
one.
Was an old movie from the 90s, I think. Yeah,
yeah.
Keith Sutherland.
But it's the same thing. It's like they're inducing near death experiences, and then they all of a sudden these entities are. I mean, from what I can deduce from the trailers, these they're starting to have these fearful experiences of things that are coming after them and stuff, and supposedly, and so that generates fear of the afterlife too.
It does, yeah. Well, fear of death, as I said, yeah. I mean, there's so many films. Paranormal Activity was a big one. You know, as I said, The Exorcist being a very big one. I mean, that scared the hell out of me as a kid. a very, very crazy
head spins
film.
Around, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's this creature, you know, possessing the girl.
And that's one where they vomit the green blood or something. Or other, some kind
yeah,
of green
the green pea soup, yeah. But, you know, yeah, It definitely is that theme, isn't it, of through these Hollywood movies of totally demonizing and scaring the hell out of people.
Rosemary's Baby,
dying.
The Omen, yeah, is another one.
But you're gonna, these things are gonna get you straight after you die, you know. And some, you know, but the, you know, with most of the NDE, near death experiences that you've read out and that you go into, it's a pretty amazing experience. But I think people are always going to see what they believed, what they were entrenched in this life, and what they watched and what they absorbed. That may be what they see and what manifests after death, or, you know, in this afterlife experience. But from all the research I've done, it seems to be a pretty amazing, incredible experience.
And some of them actually say that, you know, you can create your experience, you know, with your own will or your own thought intention.
That's right.
And so if they can convince us that it's a scary thing and we're expecting to see all these demons or something chasing after us, then that's more likely to be something that we would create or manifest ourselves, you know.
A lot of movies that you showing on your website with the in regards to the bright light, these are a lot of dark movies. You know, a lot of time of science fiction or horror movies involving the white light as well, so you've got that sort of mixture. So you've got the two sides of the coin. You don't know if they're demonizing the light, so, you know, when you die, you associate that with being something bad, or it's the other way around. So there's no kind of true way to tell, in a way.
Right. But
there's definitely that demonization there of that whole thing. I mean, you know, we talk about that a lot, you know, is when the body stops working, people think they die, but do you just go on to another existence, another plane, like you do in a dream, you know? Another level, another reality, you know, of existence that's the same as this. It's just different, you know. What's behind the veil, you know? So are they demonizing it? Are they scaring us? But, you know, you could be right there with your whole website, meaning we could be being tricked into reincarnating back and used as food as well. There's that whole side of it, absolutely, you know, because it's definitely, we're living on a planet that is totally fear-based. You have to look at it, you really do, you know. It's all around us, you know, 100%.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, it's just almost a nightmare for some people, with the hurricanes and everything that have been taking place recently.
Yeah, it's constant. It's always something, isn't it? It's, it's
everybody's in survival mode. You work
survival
half your life, just trying to keep your head above water. And it's just...
one thing... Wayne, that I was thinking about, you know, a bit off course here, but I was just, I sent you just something before. I was just looking at some Native American Indian ideas and what they believed in and stuff like that, being, you know, we have the Aboriginals in Australia, and you had the, you know, the Native tribes across America, and you look at these people, they were, people say they were primitive and everything, and they didn't have what we have today, but they seem so connected to the earth and so spiritual, but not in a church or religion kind of way. And I just sent you an article on a speech by Chief Seattle, and I just typed down some things here. They were talking about in around 1851, these tribes around Washington, Puget Sound, were faced with treaties to sell their land from the government, millions of acres to buy it back. Mm. And some words that came out from this time, they say, how can you buy or sell the sky, the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. We do not own the freshness of the air, the sparkle of the water. And so how can you buy it? He said, it says, this is every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing, every humming insect is special in the memory and experience of my people. They say the rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. The rivers carry our canoes and feed our children. If we sell our land, you must remember and teach your children that the rivers are our brothers and yours, and you must give the rivers the kindness you give, any brother. and the reflections of their people are in those. And I was thinking about, you know, this whole simulation thing about the Earth, if it is a simulation, this natural world part of the system, you know, because I think all of men, white man, red man, have been throughout time in one way or another systematically separated from nature and the natural world around them. And I think right now in history, more than any other time, you know, our modern lives right now really do resemble some type of artificial simulation. So I think, you know, in reality, if this is some kind of simulation, then where does nature come into this, do you think? Because why was it so important for whatever's doing this, you know, with the Archons or whatever it is, whoever's controlling this planet, it seemed to be very important for them to separate man and woman from nature, including our tribes, right up until today, you know, it's still going on. And you think if man spends time in nature without any distractions and electricity and phones and traffic and all of this stuff, and he just has time to reflect, you know, and I'm talking, you know, just himself and the natural world around, no, you know, only candles, no electricity, just wood and no TVs, no distractions whatsoever, no chattering and talking and busy streets, you know, you kind of have that time to connect with who you really are, but It's so far away from a church or religious sort of state, you know. You get to sort of reflect on your inner self, and you gain this kind of real knowledge that seems real and organic.
Yeah, that's the last thing you want us to do, is to have the time to...
That's right.
Listen There's to our higher sort of, spiritual essence.
Yeah, I mean... You can listen go to the churches and listen to the priest and everything, but you won't learn... what you will by yourself in the woods, you know, and you look back in those quiet moments and at your life and how fast it rushes by, you know, and how it's become a digital sort of reality, a digital life, you know, and you feel like when you know that when you go out into nature and you get away from this, you feel like you've stepped out of that reality into a completely different reality, almost into a dream state. So, and I find people nowadays
because of
talking and fidgeting as well, you know.
If this is a copy or a hologram, a simulation of the real reality, then the only thing that's really real here is our spirits that have come down to be within it. And it's maybe the nature that you're talking about, the trees and plants and things, some of the animals and things like that, they have spirit too. And so... that is what we're connecting, what you're talking about connecting with is other spirits and versus, I mean, all this tech, they want us to be more mechanical and immerse us deeper into the more technological, artificial intelligence side of it all, you know,
right.
That doesn't have any spirit. So
it doesn't have any soul, does it?
Answer.
Yeah, you're right there. Yeah, there's a reflection in nature of who we really are. And I think all our answers... are there? I mean, the new iPhones have a, you know, facial recognition technology.
Yeah.
And you know, I think they're just pushing the boundaries to see what people will take and put up with. And I see these people sleeping out front of the Apple store in Sydney to get the new iPhone for two or three
months.
Yeah,
you gotta buy
the
every new one that comes out, you gotta buy the new one.
Yeah, and they're putting their fingerprints and their facial ID in there, and I think we're becoming technology now more than ever, and I just say this because
we're going to merge.
It's almost like something's trying to it's almost like something's trying to steal or separate us from our souls or our original purpose and who we really are, you know. And I think it's getting more and more so with each day, you know, with the technology, and I just wonder about these. You know, these chiefs and these indigenous Indian cultures in the United States, who I think are amazing, you know, and they did go to war. They weren't all peace, you know. There was a lot of trouble and blood and everything spilled there. But they had this incredible connection that we seem to have lost way back then to the natural world around them, and so much respect. And I have a thing up here from Twitter which someone put up, and it says, five of Orwell's nightmares come true. It says, one... we've been dumbed down by the public education system. 2, we've been indoctrinated by the corporate-owned mass media. 3, we've been socially engineered by Hollywood movies, pop culture, music, and TV programming. 4, we've been drugged, brainwashed, and robbed by Big Pharma and this healthcare racket. And 5, we've been tricked into believing we live in a democratic society when we don't. And it's just amazing to see how far we come. And that's
as far as
all
point number 4, I just
vision.
Saw a documentary. Have you seen the documentary called What the Health? It's a really good one.
I know that one. Yeah. Some people recommended it recently to me. I haven't watched it.
It's kind of an eye-opener as to what's happening with the health system and, you know, the food we eat and all that. It's just, and it gets a little bit into the Big Pharma also. But,
yeah,
all those bullet points are very, very true.
We're being cornered, aren't we? Definitely. And we're having everything taken away. And some. You know, and that's why I asked that. I just wonder, you know, like, what is our connection to nature? Because it definitely is something there. There's definitely, you know, we're tied up with it in some way. And if it is part of the simulation, then it's been put there for a reason to show us who we really are. So mm-hmm. Or to guide us in some way. And I think that's why they've committed
well,
that
near-death
separation,
experiences.
You know.
They say that the animals and stuff do have souls or spirits. I mean, some of them have seen their pets in the light. I mean, my take on it is the very first light that they see is the lower light, and that it's part of the basically the simulation. It's not like the real world. I mean, there's higher levels and higher planes that we can go up to, and so we should. I mean, the Gnostic texts talk about there being. A higher light, which they call the light of lights or the eternal light realms, and that that there's a lower light and or an impure light, and that to me the impure light is the light that people see, or the very first light, the external light they see when they rise out of their body at death. And so my feeling is I don't want to merge with an impure light. I want to, you know, keep raising my frequency higher and higher and go to as pure a light as I possibly can. And that light is within us, according to the text. But
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, there was so much you were mentioning in there anyway. I'd need another whole show to go through it. But one thing you mentioned with the movies was the Pan's Labyrinth, and I sent you a link to a new movie. Is it Guillermo del Toro? He did Pan's Labyrinth. I think he could be Spanish or something. He does all these kind of bizarre movies, but he's got a new movie out which I sent you called The Shape of Water.
Did you just send this to me like within?
It was the other
year?
Day. I don't know if you saw. Oh, a guy was looks into symbols and all these things in movies that we're mm-hmm. talking about now, and he gave it a good write up, but. This movie's quite strange. I'll send it to you again if you can get it. I did the article up, but it's coming out in December, and it's basically about a lady who's a mute and works in a government laboratory where she hooks up with an amphibious creature. And and she actually has sex with this creature and as well, which looks reptilian in its nature. And so he's talking about the ideas of alchemical rebirth here and the Antichrist and Rosemary's Baby. So it's quite a good article, and he mm-hmm. talks about here this kind of theme of the communion of man with demon, this sort of coming together of man and demon in this. So it's quite a creepy looking field in any regard. But he goes through quite a good history and connects the movie up about these kind of demons
I received an email from a woman who had this just epic near-death experience, and she was a Buddhist or Taoist and basically a humanist. I mean, she believed in peaceful, loving philosophy, right? But she didn't believe that, like, the she would continue on after death, more or less, that, you know, everything gets kind of recycled and it dissipates. But she wasn't expecting anything. But she ended up she got real sick, you know, she was in intensive care for like 12, 13 days or whatever. But she went to this dark void. And when she was there, she said there were these seven she didn't use the word demons, but she said there was one, like lightning would like flash and she would see the image of what she called an archon. And, you know, she really didn't believe in all that stuff. Like she said that she didn't believe in like the Greek titans and the demigods and, you know, the Egyptian deities with animal heads and stuff like that until she had these experiences. And now she's like, oh my God, but she saw this being and she said it was reptilian in nature, like from at least like it had a serpent's tail or a serpentine bottom or body. And this being was just strong and ripped, you know, but he was like malevolent. She called him malevolent, and that he was very serious and could not really care less about her. But the only thing he wanted to do was see if he could use her for, he had like some kind of goal or something he wanted to win. But that when he found that she was of no use to him because she was a good hearted, not an evil person, but was kind, and he couldn't have any use for her, he just turned her over to these, she said, seven creatures that were like, she even said they were like kind of like feeding off her, but they were tormenting her with just these nonsensical stuff that didn't make sense. Like, for something like reviewing your life, but like times when you didn't, when you could have helped somebody, but you didn't, but it was something that they could have done themselves, or, you know what I'm saying? Just real picky type stuff that didn't make any sense. Like these beings didn't understand, they didn't have logic or whatever, but that, she was being tormented for like just seemed like ages and ages and ages. And at some point she said, this is BS. This is not right. I don't deserve this. That this she called her the mother, this dark mother that was like in the blackness of space, and there was like star. She was like clothed with the stars or cloaked with the stars, and she kind of referred to her as like either Mary, or she had these other Egyptian names, but basically the mother. And then she wrote me later and said that she got the feeling that these entities, and she said there were seven of them. Of course, that coincides perfectly with what the Gnostic texts talk about with the archons. But she said they were spider-like, that they reminded her of spiders. And she said especially the mother figure. Oh, but the mother was very compassionate, and she saved her from these beings. And these beings, these entities or whatever, feeding off her, they're like basically saying, but you said we could. And, you know, it's almost like they had a deal or something. They were working together. And she said that, but this woman, this mother was compassionate and saved her, but that she still didn't know whether, you know, she said, I hate to say it, you know, because she saved me, but she still wasn't sure if she was, for her highest good, you know, and she kind of questions, you know, whether she was ultimately good or not. But the fact that she said mother, and she was like a spider. I mean, the Native Americans talk about I think spider, grandmother spider or something like that. And that's part of a lot of the mythology in the South Americans also. But it's interesting how all that kind of dovetails with some of the things you were saying just a moment ago, too.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well said. That's interesting information. Anything else you want to get out there at all?
Well, I was just going to kind of summarize that, you know, the movies address philosophical issues of the nature of reality and the meaning of life, alien intervention, artificial intelligence, the simulation theory, personal identity versus the collective, and free will versus determinism, and of course the afterlife. And but one critically important theme is remaining an individual versus joining or merging with the collective. And of course, you know, the New Age movement and meditation groups are always telling us we need to kill our ego and basically merge our consciousness with the oneness. And near-death experiencers are saying the white light is a collective of all our souls. Yet it's interesting that these Gnostic theme movies, or a lot of these movies, are portraying the collective as actually being bad, it seems like. You know, Star Trek First Contact, you have the Borg, in Star Trek Return of the Archons, you have the body of Landru, and the Matrix, you have like all the Agent Smiths that were a collective, and Childhood's End, you have the Overmind. Even in the Truman Show, like all his friends were collectively keeping him from realizing his true identity. And in The Prisoner, in the last episode, they were talking about the good of the community, and that the number six escaped or was set free because of his will to remain an individual. And in Dark City, you had the collective memories that they want to imprint upon the individual. And just that, you know, the Gnostic texts mention a higher light and also an impure light. And I think the white light of the near-death experience is definitely not the higher light, in my opinion. And then the Gnostic text, Pista Sophia, it says Sophia was in the 13th eon, and she desired to go to the higher light, so she stopped performing her mysteries. And the Demiurge and the Archon rulers got angry and hated her, and they tricked her into seeing his light and thinking it was the higher light, and then they captured her. And, the Demiurge in this text, he had light. And so that kind of pretty well coincides with what I've been saying on the website. Since we're so low in matter, I think the first light we would see would still be that lower light of the Demiurge, and certainly not the light of the realms that are above. So the first lights we see are the stolen light that he stole from her, and the impure light of the lower realms. So I don't know. It's just interesting that they all... A lot of those movies, there was at least, I guess, seven of them that I just mentioned, and they all were portraying the collective as being bad. I mean, why would they? But yet the near-death experiencers and the New Age community are kind of pushing the oneness, or, you know, like you're saying, it's like it's confusing because you're getting two different stories. And it's hard to know what to choose.
I'd say do your own research. Go your own way and trust in yourself,
right.
And do your own thing. Be an individual, you know, and, keep researching, keep learning. I think that's the most important thing.
Well said. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, keep learning every day. Learn more. More and more.
Yeah, and I'd like to hear from people out there what they feel is which is the right answer, or if they have any insight that they don't want to share. I mean, they can email me at Wayne J. Bush, that's W-A-Y-N-E, the letter J, B-U-S-H, @gmail.com, and I'd love to hear from them. If they got questions or just observations, stories, anything. Love hearing from people.
Good. Yeah, and your website's trickedbythelight.com. And
right.
I've got a picture here of Truman Show with Truman sitting on the beach looking at the moon. So I have to use that today because it's that kind of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
It's like you've got the waves, the ocean, and the moon.
I highly recommend it.
What's real? Is it real?
I gave everybody in 90 minutes or so, the time it takes to watch one movie, I just gave you about 24 movies or so and give you a fast forward through all of them.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what's interesting about the Truman one is they created an artificial reality within.
Yeah.
You know, they created their own world with the ocean and sky and everything, you know, that he thought was real, which wasn't. They actually created it, you know. So that's something to ponder as well, you know. Because that's what you, right. You know, you think. You're looking at the moon, you know. You're thinking,
we accept the reality.
What's going on there?
We don't question it. Our parents tell us it's true. Our teachers tell us it's true. Our scientists tell us it's true. It's church.
Yeah, thing. Science lessons in school. Growing up, they tell you there's space and there's the stars and there's the moon and there's Pluto and there's Mars and there's this and there's that, and you live on this planet and, you know, the sun goes around. It's like that's what you believe. You wonder what's really out there beyond the sky, you know. Like Truman, you wonder, you know, if you went
right
out there,
at one point,
could you go any
the
further?
Earth was the center of the universe, and nobody questioned it. So, you know, one fellow came along and they burned him at the stake or something.
That's right. I don't know how can there be this space out there that's in infinity, you know, that never ends. It's weird. You wonder, is that how it really is? You know. Truman is, you know, I don't know. Just wonder what happens. Yeah, they shoot these rockets up, but are they really going up out of the atmosphere? You know, it doesn't. I don't know. I never don't really see any proper footage of the planet. You know, it's all simulated. It's all drawings and make believe. You know, no, you can't trust anything they tell us or say. You know, and that's the way it's always been, and so you're led to believe this, and you carry this one vision through your whole life of where you lived and what you saw and what you believed. But you know,
sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, right?
That's right, and that's why I was mentioning this picture of Truman sitting on the beach in the dark, looking at the moon, you know, and the waves. It's a great picture. I'll definitely use that today, and people will probably want to go and watch that film. I know I will again.
I actually want to watch some of these movies again. Like I watched the whole Matrix trilogy, preparing for this, and taking notes all the way through. And I definitely saw more insights this time around than I saw when I watched it a few years ago.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, watch a US series called Colony. I think it's going into a third season as well. That's an interesting one. I'll send you the link anyway to watch it for free. Yeah, it's a good one. You'll like that. Well, great show today. Anyway, great show. And a lot of information put out again. And I think we're going to do another one soon on symbolism or wording.
Language,
is that the way? Language, logos, all this kind of stuff. And how
we could do one on music possibly too, if you're interested in that.
Yeah. Well, I sent you one the other day of an artist called Beck. His new album cover, classic symbolism, Colors, I think.
Yeah, and then, of course, his big hit single was You're a Loser Baby, So Why Don't You Kill Me, or something like that.
Yeah,
I'm a Loser Baby, So Why Don't You Kill Me. And what kind of message is that? Talk about negative messages.
You had that.
Tongue in cheek, but come on, it's pretty.
No, you've had that right through history. You know, you look back at the Doors, and they all died. You know, you look at the Nirvana guy, Kurt Cobain, dying, and all these, celebrities and music celebrities dying on certain days, and you know, Heath Ledger, I think, and an Australian guy, and many Hollywood stars just suddenly dying. You know, for no reason, just bizarre. It's like it really is like a cult.
Well, Jim Morrison,
people in Hollywood have said that
with his poetry of that stuff. It seems like he was starting to maybe reveal the truth. He was talking about the lords of the what did he call them? But they were like, he was talking about the lizard king and all that kind of stuff. But he was like saying that sometimes they give themselves away with but he was saying cinema is there where they like to. I can't even remember the quotes now. It's been so long, but I've got it on my website. But yeah, he was starting to talk about some stuff that maybe they didn't like so much.
I think the actor Randy Quaid has been going on about this. He calls them star whackers in Hollywood, and they were trying to whack him, and him and his wife fled to Canada. And he's open. You can go on YouTube and watch him. He made Independence Day in a lot of movies, but not anymore. But obviously they're trying to, or something with his money, but he came out and called them star whackers. You can see his interview that they just knocked them off. It's weird, Robin Williams, so many, and you're just thinking this is a weird thing going on over there, and it does seem very symbolic and very occult-like, you know? It seems like these people are doing a pact, making a pact with something, and they're going in, and then these things are happening. It's very strange.
If they make a deal with the devil, or the demiurge or something like that for fame and fortune or something like that, and then they get it, but maybe they feel a little guilty about selling out all the people, so maybe this is, and they can't like literally tell us because they'll get killed, or maybe they just literally can't. They don't have to, like their mouths, but maybe that's their way of telling us the truth is through symbolism or lyrics, and you know what I'm saying? It's they can't tell us straight out. Of course, it's all at one level, it's probably all a game, you know.
That's they're right.
Gatekeepers, and you know,
maybe they're not even really dying. maybe they're not even really dying. Maybe they just take them somewhere. Right. Who knows?
Well, yeah, Jim Morrison's father was an admiral in the Navy. I mean, there's all these things.
Yeah, they all were.
You know, and they make comments about how they would just want to leave society and go somewhere, and who knows. Sometimes
it's
the body's...
Very influential. Very influential music anyway. It's, you know, had a huge hold. But, that would be good to go into anyway. Yeah, very interesting. Oh, no.
Yeah, it's such a vast topic. I mean, I know Madonna's got a song called The Illuminati where she's like trying to say...
Sure, you've got a lot of material there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, stuff I haven't even looked at. I mean, I've got a lot on my website, but it's mostly classic rock and stuff like that. And I don't get too much into the hip hop and the pop music, but I'm sure I could do a little research and find all kinds of stuff. I mean, I do touch on some of the, you know, Katy Perry stuff and even like a J-Lo video and things like that. I mean, I heard that Rihanna recently came out in the VMA Awards or something like that. And she was dressed as the Virgin Mary. And she was like, you know, looking pregnant and all this stuff, and people were like appalled that she would, because she's, you know, obviously not Catholic or whatever. So I don't know if you heard about that one or not, but there's, you know, the way they, a lot of these awards ceremonies, I mean, that's very mild compared to some of the stuff that, you know, they do with the Lady Gaga with the being immersed in blood or what, you know, the ritualistic aspect of it. And, some of the others that, you know, Pink was like held upside down and she was wearing like this Masonic black and white checkered outfit. And then you have, I think the Red Hot Chili Peppers one day, I mean, maybe it was tongue in cheek, but they got an award on the MTV Music Awards and they came out and they said, we'd like to thank Satan, you know, with a straight face, they're saying it, you know, but I mean, maybe they're kidding, but probably not.
No. Yeah, it's all about cannibalism now. It's all these shows about they're eating each other now, eating flesh. So it's, don't get any darker. And they're dragging us down, for sure.
I try not to dwell on the fearful.
I just watch it and
gory. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you could do, but I wanted to keep it more on the, what's the real truth behind it all. And
that's right.
I thought this was a little more uplifting and positive and more empowering.
That's right.
But yeah, it is important to expose the dark side of it all, too, for sure. I'll try to do more of that, like in the language and logos.
That's right. Oh, it'll be great. All right. Well, we've come to the end, and thanks for your time again. You're amazing guy, so thanks very much, and I'll be putting this up tonight, so it'll be another popular one, and I'll send it through to you.
Amazing.
We'll do this again soon.
You have so many great articles on it. And,
keep it going, keep it interesting.
Yeah.
Keep it all different stuff. I'm going to be adding more categories soon, so plenty to go through as well.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for your time today. Great chat. And
I enjoyed it.
Give people anytime. Lots to ponder.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, thank you. And
all right.
I guess until next time.
Thanks, Wayne. And tricksitbythelight.com. I'll put the link up today, of course, people to go and check it out. And thanks for listening. Thanks for being here, Wayne. And we'll catch up again soon for the next segment as we keep going forward.
All right. Thanks again. Have a good night.
Thanks, buddy.
Wakonda, Ladan Wapatha, Atohi. The great chief in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. He asks much of us. But it will not be easy, for this land is sacred to us. How can you buy or sell the sky, the rain, and the wind? That idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every sandy shore, shining pine needle, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing and humming insect is holy in the memory and experience of my people. I know the sap that courses through the trees as I know the blood that flows in my own veins. The shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our grandfathers' grandfathers. The air is precious. It shares its spirit with all the life it supports. The wind that gave me my first breath will receive my last sigh. We are part of the earth and it is part of us. The rocky crests, the meadows, the ponies, all belong to the same family. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The water's murmur is the voice of your great-great-grandmother. Each ghostly reflection in the clear waters of the lake tells of memories in the life of our people. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst, they carry our canoes, and feed our children. You must give to the rivers the kindness you would give to any brother. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. The destiny of your people is a mystery to us. We know that the white man does not understand our ways. One portion of the land is the same to him as the next, for he is a stranger who comes in the night and takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy, and when he has conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's grave behind and he does not care. He kidnaps the earth from his children and he does not care. His father's grave and his children's birthright are forgotten. He treats his mother, the earth, and his brother, the sky, as things to be bought, plundered, sold like sheep or bright beasts. His appetite will devour the earth and leave behind only a desert. Contaminate your bed, and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses tamed? What will happen when the secret corners of the forest are heavy with the scent of many men? When the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? What will happen when we say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt? When the last red man and woman have vanished with their wilderness, and their memory is only a shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, will the shores and forests still be there? Will there be any spirit of my people left? It will be the end of living and the beginning of survival. We love this earth as a newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. If we sell you our land, care for it as we have cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you receive it. Preserve the land and the air and the rivers for your children's children and love it as we have loved it. The earth is our mother. What befalls the earth befalls all the sons and daughters of the earth.